Are you ready for this morning's parenting program from above?
Yeah!
Let me put on my wife's reading glasses since I broke mine 2 days ago. You can whistle or just make comments directly after the fellowship.
Well, we will.
Our guest speakers from the Atlanta Church of Christ, Athens, thank you. Mike and Mary Shapiro are psychologists who have been in private practice in Athens, Georgia for over 25 years. Mike also serves as an elder in the Athens Church. He specializes in the diagnosis and treatment of children with neurological, developmental, psychiatric, and behavioral problems. They both received their doctorates at the University of Georgia. Mike is also on the faculty of Piedmont College. Mike and Mary have authored 2 publications for DPI, Rejoice Always, and Understanding Sexual Behavior in Children. They have spoken extensively both here and abroad on topics related to parenting, mental health, and marriage in a Christian context. Mike is also, I believe, a black belt martial artist. He is an avid Ducati sport bike rider, which he and I are going to be riding in 3 weeks. So in Athens, apparently he is known as the most interesting man alive. And his wife Mary told me that he had an awkward moment once, just to see what it felt like. So we're going to have one more song. Let's stand on up. Then I give you Mike and Mary Shapiro from the Athens Church of Christ.
I'm really happy to be with the brothers first this morning. And I have to confess, I am scared to death of standing in front of a room full of your wives. So I'm glad I'm talking to you first. Now I'm afraid, like, after 3 hours with the women, I'm going to be like, oh, sister, I just love those shoes. I want that to happen. If I do that, just beat me up or something. I don't know. That was a great introduction, but I want you to know that in addition to our extensive professional credentials, we have 3, count them, 3 children who are all great disciples by the grace of God. Amen. They are 24 years old, 23 years old, and 19 years old. The eldest two are married to great disciples. And one of those great disciples to whom our child is married is Henry Kramer's daughter. So we have this connection with the Kramer family, but we're still sane somehow. I don't know how that happened. You know, you think about it, our 3 kids were raised by 2 psychologists. The fact that they're disciples, it must be God. You know, because why aren't they like the most messed up kids on the planet? You know, and we use them for experiments, and we analyze them all the time. So, like I said, it's God. It had nothing to do with us. This morning, we're going to talk about the legacy of parenting. The premise of this talk is this. Whatever we do as parents, whether you're the dad or the mom, for good or bad, like it or not, whatever we do is going to mold our children's character for the rest of their lives and determine what kind of parents they're going to be. And if what we do determines what kind of parents our kids are going to be, that means what they do is going to determine what kind of parents their kids are going to be. So we are leaving a multi-generation legacy by the way we parent our kids. Not too much responsibility, wouldn't you say? Let me ask you some questions before we start. How many of you guys are dads of preschoolers like 0 to 4? Raise your hands. Whoa. Bless you. All right, your chance now. How many of you are parents of kids like between 6 and 12? Wow, okay, so many of you have multiple kids or else the math isn't working out here. How many of you are parents of teenagers? Wow, this is a be fruitful and multiply. How many of you are the parents of adults? Amen. Okay, look around. These guys with their hands up right now, those are the guys you seek advice from. Okay, now you put your hands down. They've made it. Now, how many of you, when you had your child, were issued an owner's manual? You lied. Okay, rebuke you for lying. Oh, no, I'm sorry. They're holding up their Bibles. Okay, so take that back. You're right. You're absolutely right. That was the man. Dude, that's never happened before. That is a trick question. Okay. You know, you think about it, though, it's weird. You know, you buy a... I went to this Sony place in the mall yesterday to buy a camera, which you saw me use for the game. And it came with a manual that, like, you need an engineering degree from MIT to read and understand this thing. You can't buy a camera or a telephone or even a, you know, I mean, you can't buy anything these days that's electronic without having a manual this thick, right? A cell phone, you know, a CrackBerry. I mean, that's like, it takes a degree to learn how to use that thing. Yet, who of us, when we had a kid, had any kind of written anything? I mean, it's really like we're on our own, right? So how are you supposed to learn this stuff? How are you supposed to learn how to be a parent? For most of us, if you were not raised by disciples, how did you learn to be a parent? From? Your parents. Very good class. That's right. Now, some of what you learned from your parents, was it not absolutely priceless? I got to hang out with Henry's mother yesterday. She is a fountain of parenting godly wisdom. You know, it's like you can listen to her forever, talk about how she raised these unruly boys, you know, and they came out to be reasonably decent human beings. So some of what you learn from your parents is awesome and priceless. Some of what you learn, though, you learn the other way around, right? It's like you saw what your parents did, and what did you say? I'm never going to do that. So you learn from your parents, but you kind of learn in reverse, you know? How many times have you said, I'm never going to do that when I have kids, and then you find yourself doing that? Yeah, that happens all the time. Actually, that happens more the older you get. It's kind of scary. Either way, for good or for bad, like I said, you learn at least in part of what you learn from your own parents. So every parent in here, every one of you guys is going to leave a legacy. You know, we see it all the time in our office. The effects of good or bad parenting have huge ramifications. And they go from generation to generation. It's amazing. What happens in kids' childhood, what happens to you in your childhood, literally molds your character. It's really amazing. So you've got to be careful. What you do as a parent is going to establish or help to establish the path that this kid takes for the rest of his life. If I've learned one thing, I'm going to say this like eight times, so it'll be eight one things I've learned. If I learned one thing in my years as a psychologist, it's that the human ego is the most fragile thing on the planet. You know, tissue paper is not as fragile. The human hair is not as fragile. The human ego can be damaged so easily. It just amazes me. I don't know why that is. I'll have to ask God. So when you're young, impressions can be made on your self-esteem and on your psyche that will follow you for the rest of your lives, right? You know, think about yourselves. How many of your own traits and your own tendencies and characteristics can you attribute to the way you were raised? I'll go first. I was raised by a single parent. My dad passed away when I was young. I think I had just turned 9. So my mom worked hard. I've got 2 older sisters. She worked hard. She went right to work. Worked hard to raise us. And you may not know, but I'm Jewish by birth and by genetics. If you know anything about Jewish moms, they put, and to this day, my 87-year-old mother, they put their kids above everything. You know, to my mom, God bless her, her kids are more her God, you know, which is not a good thing. We're working on it. But she values her kids, if you know anything about Jewish culture. I knew when I was growing up that this woman would do anything for me. She put her kids over herself, far and above over herself, almost to the point of being absurd sometimes. You know, this woman, for example, she never broke a law in her life. She's never even gotten a speeding ticket, which just amazes me. But when the Vietnam War, when it looked like I might get drafted, she concocted this plan of how she was going to get me out of the country. If you know my mom, this is so not like her. But it just goes to show you the extent to which she put me above anything, you know. When I became a disciple, I felt like there were some sins I needed to confess to her. She refused to believe them. She even at one point went like this. I mean, I should have known, but I felt like I had to get it off my chest anyway. But that's the way she was. So, what was the important and lasting legacy she left me? Unconditional love. She is the queen of unconditional love. Now, the good part about that, it's good and bad, the good part was that it made me feel secure, gave me very good, healthy self-esteem. Later, when I became a Christian, you know how a lot of people struggle with God's unconditional love when they're becoming disciples? That's a big issue. That wasn't my issue. You know, I thought, my mom thought I was the bomb, therefore I thought I was the bomb, therefore God must think I'm the bomb. I mean, I had no problem with God's unconditional love. You know, because that's the way my mom was. So that was the legacy she left me. Now, on the bad side, by nature, I took advantage of her unconditional love. You know, I knew my mom would always bail me out. Whatever I did, even if it was 110% my fault, I knew she'd always bail me out. Even when I was in financial trouble, and this is a woman who had to work hard to support the family, but I knew if I ever got in financial trouble, she'd bail me out. So later in life, when I became a Christian and I developed convictions about what a godly man is supposed to be like, I had to deal with laziness and selfishness and financial irresponsibility. By the grace of God, you know, I thought, okay, this is something I got to work on. If I hadn't become a disciple, I'd still be spoiled, lazy, irresponsible, and expect someone to bail me out of everything. You know, I'm glad she doesn't come to these things because she might get mad. But I would come home from college, you know, and with Jewish moms, food is everything. You know, it's like Italian moms, food is everything. So if I came home and I said, gee, Mom, I have I'm jonesing for, you know, meat from the North African yak, which is only found in season. You know, she'd go, oh, I'll be right back. I'll go get it, you know. She had to go out in the snow. I'll be right back. She'd do it, you know. I'm not advising you to be that way, though. Now, think about it. Let's go back to this concept of what we do with our kids is going to affect multiple generations. Think about this. If your kids should choose to become disciples, then they, your kids, will be leaders of your churches. Even if they choose to have nothing to do with God and your church, they're going to lead something. They're going to be leaders of your community. Eventually, like it or not, they might be leaders of your country, right? Now, that's going to force you to stretch your imagination when you're thinking, my kid can't even keep his room clean, and he's going to lead the country someday. Well, yeah, that's what's going to happen. So, since your kids will one day be leading the nation, the kind of parent you are now is going to affect what kind of country your kids are going to live in. Parenting is that serious. If so, I'm thinking we should be devoting a lot more time to studying biblical parenting. Much more time and energy in the pursuit of being a good parent. Not just the Psalms or the Proverbs or the little nuggets that we see that are specifically about parenting, but the whole Bible. We need to read our Old Testament because that's where God shows by example how to be a good parent to His family, the Israelites. In fact, we're going to read one of His lessons. In Leviticus 26, now you know when you get a Jew up here, we're going to Old Testament, right? I'm going to read, be prepared, because I'm going to read this whole chapter. But I want you to listen carefully, and then we're going to talk about what an awesome lesson on parenting this is. It's the ultimate, in my opinion, this is like the ultimate parenting manual, this single chapter. Leviticus 26. All right, I hope these don't look as bad as Joel's, right?
Hey.
How he looked in his. All right, this is what it says. This is God talking to His kids, right, to set the stage. Do not make idols or set up an image or a sacred stone for yourselves. Do not place a carved stone in your land to bow down before it. I am the Lord your God. Observe my Sabbaths and have reverence for my sanctuary. I am the Lord. If you follow my decrees and are careful to obey my commands, I will send you rain in its season, and the ground will yield its crops and the trees of the field their fruit. Your threshing will continue until grape harvest, and the grape harvest will continue until planting, and you will eat all the food you want and live safely in your land. I'll grant peace in the land, and you'll lie down, and no one will make you afraid. I'll remove savage beasts from the land, and the sword will not pass through your country. You'll pursue your enemies, and they'll fall by the sword before you. 5 of you will chase 100, 100 of you will chase 10,000, and your enemies will fall by the sword before you. I will look on you with favor and make you fruitful and increase your numbers, and I'll keep my covenant with you. You'll still be eating last year's harvest when you have to move it out to make room for the new. I'll put my dwelling place among you, and I will not abhor you. I will walk among you and be your God, and you will be my people. I am the Lord your God who brought you out of Egypt so that you would no longer be slaves to the Egyptians. I broke the bars of your yoke and enabled you to walk with heads held high. But if you will not listen to me and carry out all these commands, and if you reject my decrees and abhor my laws and fail to carry out all my commands and so violate my covenant, then this I will do to you. I'll bring upon you sudden terror, wasting diseases and fever that will destroy your sight and drain away your life. You'll plant seed in vain because your enemies will eat it. I'll set my face against you so that you will be defeated by your enemies. Those who hate you will rule over you. And you will flee, even when no one is pursuing you. If after all this, you still won't listen to me, I'll punish you for your sins 7 times over. I'll break down your stubborn pride and make the sky above you like iron and the ground beneath you like bronze. Your strength will be spent in vain because your soil will not yield its crops, nor will the trees of the land yield their fruit. If you remain hostile towards me and refuse to listen to me, I will multiply your afflictions 7 times over. As your sins deserve, I'll send wild animals against you, and they'll rob you of your children, destroy your cattle, and make you so few in number that your roads will be deserted. If, in spite of these things, you do not accept my correction, but continue to be hostile towards me, I myself will be hostile towards you, and will afflict you for your sins 7 times over, and I'll bring the sword upon you to avenge the breaking of the covenant. When you withdraw into your cities, I'll send a plague among you, and you'll be given into enemy hands. When I cut off your supply of bread, 10 women will be able to bake your bread in one oven, and they'll dole out bread by weight. You'll eat it, but you won't be satisfied. If, in spite of this, you still do not listen to me, but continue to be hostile towards me, then in my anger I'll be hostile towards you, and I myself will punish you for your sins 7 times over. You'll eat the flesh of your sons and the flesh of your daughters, as you know, that actually came to be. I will destroy your high places, cut down your incense altars, and pile your dead bodies on the lifeless forms of your idols, and I will abhor you. I'll turn your cities into ruins and lay waste to your sanctuaries, and I'll take no delight in the pleasing aroma of your offerings. I'll lay waste to the land so that your enemies who live there will be appalled. I'll scatter you among the nations and will draw out my sword and pursue you. Your land will be laid waste, and your cities will lie in ruins. Then the land will enjoy its Sabbath years all the time that it lies desolate here in the country of your enemies. Then the land will rest and enjoy its Sabbaths all the time that it lies desolate. The land will have the rest it did not have during the Sabbaths lived in it. As for those who are left, I will make their hearts so fearful in the lands of their enemies that the sound of a wind-blown leaf will put them to flight. They'll run as though fleeing from the sword, and they'll fall even though no one is pursuing them. They'll stumble over one another as though fleeing from the sword, even though no one is pursuing them. So you will not be able to stand before your enemies. You'll perish among the nations. The land of your enemies will devour you. Those of you who are left will waste away in the lands of their enemies because of their sins, and also because of their father's sins, they will waste away. Now watch this. But if they will confess their sins and the sins of their fathers, their treachery against me and their hostility toward me, which made me hostile towards them so that I sent them into the land of their enemies, then when their uncircumcised hearts are humbled and they pay for their sin, I will remember my covenant with Jacob, my covenant with Isaac, and my covenant with Abraham, and I will remember the land. For the land will be deserted by them and will enjoy its Sabbath while it lies desolate without them. They'll pay for their sins because they rejected my laws and abhorred my decrees. Yet in spite of this, when they're in the land of their enemies, I will not reject them or abhor them so as to destroy them completely, breaking my covenant with them. I am the Lord their God. But for their sake, I will remember the covenant with their ancestors whom I brought out of Egypt in the sight of the nations to be their God. I am the Lord. Wow. Okay, guys, thanks. It's been great. And that should almost do it right there. That's an amazing scripture. I love that chapter. Let's see what God did. What can we learn from this about being a parent? First thing, what does he say several times in the first few verses? I am the Lord your God. God, number one, makes it clear who's boss, doesn't he? That's why he says it so many times. Who's boss and who calls the shots and who's in authority? He makes that very clear. In fact, he does it to a point that's, you know, we're like, after the first few scriptures, we're like pretty scared, right? But this is an extremely important part of parenting, especially for dads, is to establish your authority. Now, many of our own parents raised us that way, right? I can't say that Mary and I are seeing this a lot in our office. It's actually less and less as the years go by. You know, nowadays, it seems to me more and more parents in the world anyway are relinquishing their authority to their kids. Sometimes because, you know, it's because they don't want their kids to feel oppressed or stifled, you know. Sometimes it's because, and this is bad, they're afraid that to exert their authority, their kids aren't going to like them, which is probably the worst. And I say this to dads in my office, I must say this 100 times a week. When your kids are little, they don't need a pal. They don't need a buddy. They got those in preschool and elementary school and down the street and on their t-ball team. What they need at that point is to know that there is an ultimate authority in the household. That there is a long arm of the law, the hand of God in that household. One who gives the law and metes out the justice. And they're going to resent it just like the Israelites did, right? But let me tell you, in truth, they really, really crave that. Trust me on this, as a child psychologist, they need it to feel secure. So that's why God made it abundantly clear right from the start, who's in control. I do a lot of custody evaluations. I get hired by the court when a family's going through divorce, right? And the judge needs to know which parent to put the child with. And I interview everybody, each parent and the kids, and I do tests. But at some point during my interview with each kid, I ask them this. I say, describe for me what it's like. By this time, their parents are separated. I say, what's it like at mom's house? I'm just going to say mom, but this is interchangeable. And they'll say, oh, she makes me do my homework and brush my teeth and you know, shower and stuff. I have to go to bed on time. Then I say, what's it like at your dad's house? And usually they're with their dad every other weekend. It's the whole, I call it Disney World dad thing. I say, what's it like at dad's house when you go there? Oh, it's awesome. We get to stay up as long as we want. He feeds us anything we want. We watch movies until 3 a.m. We play Grand Theft Auto. You know, it's like all the worst things. And he's saying, huh? Oops, yeah, we're not kidding. So they say all this stuff, and they're all enthused about it. And then I say, well, who would you rather live with? And they look at me like I had just asked them, and, you know, I'm from Mars or something. And they say, mom, of course. And it's because kids at some level know they need the security, the consistency, and the authority.
Yes.
So that's what God does first. Establishes who's the head of the household, right? What does he do next? He gave his children rules. In fact, if you want to look at more of them, it's all through Leviticus, the rules he gives. Now, the reasons for some of these rules are pretty obvious. They're safety things, you know. Don't eat this because it'll make you sick. Don't do this. You know, a lot of them are for safety. A lot of them are to show how unattainable he is, you know, how we can't earn his grace by our works. But a lot of them are kind of, you know, not obvious, right? I don't want to say weird because then I'll be struck dead right here. Some of them, we can't tell what the rules are all about, right? I mean, I love my Old Testament. I read it a lot. And some of them I go, why would God want that? I don't know. It's the same way with our kids, though, right? We're going to give them rules to keep them safe. A lot of them, they're not going to understand. Well, that's okay. They don't have to understand. And a lot of them will seem contradictory. If you're a disciple, you're trying to raise your kid to be friendly. So you say, Now look people in the eye and smile and be happy. But then, if you're out and someone comes to offer you candy, don't look at them. Turn away from them and run screaming, you know? So a lot of our rules are even contradictory. And it's like, what? You know, poor kids don't understand that. They don't have to understand it. It is fully within your God-given capacity to say, because I told you so. I hereby grant you permission to say, because I told you so. That's perfectly acceptable.
Well, don't abuse it.
That's a little too enthusiastic about that. But it's true. It's true. You know, our kids will not understand every rule we lay down, but we have good reason for them. All they have to do is trust us and obey.
That's it.
Yeah. Two things God was asking His kids to do in this chapter. What does He do next? And this is the most awesome gift God gives us. He gives His children a choice. Henry Kramer has this motto. We have, what is it? We have choices and freedom. God does the same thing. He gives them the freedom to obey or disobey. He gives them free will. That's the greatest gift God has given us, and it's the greatest gift we can give to our kids. You know, like it or not, our kids have that same option. They have free will. And it comes right down to it. I don't think we want it any other way. We don't want, I mean, some days we do want mindless automatons who will obey us. Some days. But long term, we don't want kids like that, I don't think. We want them to obey willingly, not out of compulsion or because they're scared of us or threatened, right? So we want them to learn how to think critically. We want them to learn how to protect themselves and to give love willingly.
Yes.
Now, there's no doubt about it. God loves His children. He wants to bless them. Mm-hmm. However, He clearly, in this chapter, He says what His expectations are. And He's very, we call this consistency in parenting. He doesn't equivocate. He makes it clear what His expectations are. He says, these expectations will never change. No matter what you do, my expectations and my rules will never change. He also tells them clearly what kind of rewards they're going to receive for obedience. He does that in the first part of chapter 26. This is what you're going to get if you just trust me and obey me. After He does that, tells them what abundant rewards they're going to receive if they obey, He gives them a litany of pretty severe punishments. Now, I'm not advocating that you cannibalize your children or, you know, let a plague into their bedroom or anything like that. You know, that's God's forms of discipline, not ours. But you have to think, when you're reading that, it's like, doesn't God sound kind of harsh? What could justify those terrorizing threats? It's this. What is it that God ultimately wants from us? He wants just what every parent wants. He wants His kids to have a good, safe life. But He also wants them to have a relationship with Him. That's what the whole chapter is about. Establishing a relationship with His kids. And if you'll notice, despite these horrendous punishments, it's like, oh my goodness, that's like terrifying. What does it come down to in verse 40? He says, no matter what you do, no matter how bad it gets, at any point in this deal, if you want to turn back to me and repent and confess, I'll still love you. That's the ultimate gift. And even though, as you know the rest of the story, they continued to disobey, didn't they? If I had been in the presence of Moses hearing this stuff, I would have said, yeah, I'm good. I will never disobey. That scares me so much. You know, but they continued to disobey. But He never stopped having a relationship with them. Otherwise, we wouldn't have the Bible beyond the Old Testament, right? There wouldn't be the rest of the books. He'd have to continue to talk through prophets and judges and kings. But that was unconditional love. And this is a lesson that some parents, and dads especially, to tell you the truth, need to learn. You know, I've known, in the practice, we've seen parents disown their kids over a million things. Some trivial and sometimes. Some parents disown their kids over their beliefs. Some parents disown their kids over being gay, or getting an earring, or getting a tattoo, or being a Republican, which that one I could understand. But hey, it's just me. Just me. All right? I could could come close on that one. But, now, he tells us, God tells us the consequences of the behavior, the bad behavior, but he never withdraws his love. How do we know that? Because you read John 3:16. It's the most quoted verse in the world. He allowed his son to die for us so that we could be forgiven no matter how bad the thing is we would ever do. Does that make sense?
Yes.
What is it that every Christian parent wants the most, more than anything? For the kids to become disciples one day.
Yes.
And every Christian I know does pretty much all he can do. I know some great dads, awesome dads, that do everything they know how to do to lead their children to God. At some point, though, it's going to come down to a personal decision through free will for that child to follow God or follow the world. A parent can't force his child to follow God. The ones that think you can, they usually fail. And then what happens? They end up the rest of their lives feeling guilty, like they were responsible for their child's failure to follow God. Even though the Bible says later in Ezekiel, you can write it down, Ezekiel 18:20 says the child doesn't share the guilt for the sins of his father. In other words, dads, you do the best you can, and you're guilt-free if your child decides to follow the world, because it's a child's decision. But the point is, a father's sins has repercussions, and a father's godly parenthood also has repercussions. You know, you look at David. He wasn't always the best dad, was he?
No.
Wasn't always the godliest man, was he? In fact, his sins resulted directly in the death of a son. You read that in 2 Samuel 12. His own children rebelled against him. Several of them met a bad end. But he was a man of God, and he was always willing to submit to God's authority. And as a result, even if he had a bad influence on some of his kids, he had a mega influence on other kings, other kingdoms, other generations, right out all the way to us. He had influences beyond those of his own kids. We're still talking about him today. Or you look at Timothy. In 2 Timothy 1, Paul talks about Timothy's grandmother, right? His grandmother Lois. Her influence, apparently, Lois's godly influence, lasted two generations. You see what I'm saying? So the things you do with your children, it may or may not work out at the moment. It might work out later on for them or for their children. The best thing you can do is leave a spiritual legacy. Actually, men, you leave two kinds of legacies. You leave a worldly legacy and a spiritual legacy. When you assert your authority, you make rules, you control consequences. When you're doing that, you're just doing no more than trying to get them to be decent human beings, right? Decent citizens. Even if you weren't disciples, you'd be trying to get them to do that, right? However, the spiritual legacy, even though you can't force them to be disciples, you can inspire them. You can inspire them with your lives. You can show them by example. You can teach them God's word. That's why God, we're going to look in Deuteronomy, and I'm almost done talking, and I'm going to let Mary talk. In Deuteronomy 11, 18, this is why God is so adamant about this. Deuteronomy 11. When I put my glasses on, it all became clear. 11:18. Fix these words of mine in your hearts and minds. Tie them as symbols on your hands and bind them on your foreheads. Teach them to your children, talking about them when you sit at home, when you walk along the road, when you lie down, and when you get up. Write them on the door frames of your houses and on your gates, so that your days and the days of your children may be many in the land that the Lord swore to give to your forefathers, as many as the days that the heavens are above the earth. So the best thing you can do as dads, really, is to hold steadfastly to your faith, regardless of what your kids do. Hold to your faith. Inspire your kids with your commitment to God, regardless of what your kids decide to do. Inspire them with your convictions and the way you follow the Word. Don't let their behavior modify your commitment to God. Right?
Yes.
I'm far from a perfect parent. Trust me on that. I've done many things wrong. One thing I can tell you, though, that I'm kind of proud of is when my kids were growing up, every morning, good or bad, when they came down their stairs in their little jammies, they were absolutely certain to see their dad sitting in the study reading his Bible. Now, I might have messed up a million other things, but they always remember that.
Yes.
And that draw, now they do. We go on these family vacations. We all get up now. We're all studying together. It's awesome, you know? So the best thing you can do, you can't force them to become disciples, but you can inspire them with the commitment, the conviction of your own life, regardless of what they do. And you don't compromise if they choose to follow the world. I'm going to get Mary to come up, and she's going to give you some more practical. I'm the theory guy. She's really the more practical guy on things you can do to inspire your kids.
To tell you, first of all, looking around this room is a really unique experience for me, and I kind of feel like I wandered into the wrong gym class. So. But, you know, God is really good because he sent me one sister this morning that had to come to this workshop, and Laura, I've got her sitting right here in the front row, and do not leave me, sister, all right? You know, the other thing, as Michael said, I mean, you have to know there's a couple of important duties I have in our marriage and partnership. You know, one is, for those of you who were concerned about Michael's political views that he airs so freely, one of my duties is to go to the voting booth and erase his vote. As he said, he does the Old Testament, and he's going to give you the theory and the psychological research. I'm just here this morning to share some practicals with you. So that's what I hope to do this morning. You know, the first practical is I want to urge you, brothers, do everything you can to develop a close, good relationship with each one of your children. Each one of your children. You know, ultimately, the quality of your relationship is going to determine how much influence you have over that child, over that child's beliefs, over that child's behavior. It's going to be built on the relationship that you have. Later on in the morning, we're going to talk about disciplining techniques, specific disciplining techniques. But it's interesting to me that when you look at the research on a lot of different discipline techniques, one of the consistent findings is that technique is only as effective as the relationship is with the parent. You know, if it's a good relationship with the parent, then it's likely to be a more effective discipline technique. So everything really revolves around your relationship with your child, what the quality of that relationship is. You know, I don't have anything new to share with you on this. I mean, you go back to the basics on this. In order to have a great relationship with your child, you've got to spend time with that child.
Yes,
one-on-one, not,
right.
You know, not in a group setting. I mean, there's a lot of family group setting, and we're going to talk about the influence of a family atmosphere later on in the morning and how important that is. But if you and that one child are going to know each other, you've got to spend some time with them, one-on-one. And this is going to take some doing. You know, I don't think any of you, you know, raise your hand if you're, you know, independently wealthy and retired and have all this time to spend with kids. But most of us have very busy lives. So you're going to have to schedule it some way. And I'll brag on Michael. When our kids were little, he came to it every week. We had three kids, and he, you know, the office was very busy. He didn't have time every week to do a date with each child. But they would rotate their weeks, and on Friday morning, he would get the kids up, and they would go to Waffle House. You guys don't have Waffle House in California, right?
No.
If you don't know what Waffle House is,
go to Denver.
The worst place to eat.
No.
Truck driver food, all right? Bread, cheese, eggs, all right? I mean, cholesterol, everything, you know? So Michael would take one of the kids and go run their arteries at Waffle House. You know? But the kids knew, I mean, they knew whose week it was. You know, they knew on the rotation who got the date with Dad that week. It was a big deal. It was a big deal to go to Waffle House with Michael. You know, so you got to figure out something to do where you have that one-to-one time with your children. You know, when you do have that time, make it something fun. Have fun with them. Don't just make it an appointment that you get through. You know, find out what they like to do and do it. Michael talks a lot about our oldest daughter especially is a very feminine girl, was from day one, very feminine. And her idea of fun is, you know, going to the Disney shop and dressing up as, you know, in the princess outfits
yes,
or something. I mean,
that,
you know. And so that's what Michael did with her. I mean, they would do girly things that Michael didn't have a clue, you know, what he was doing, you know. But something that she enjoyed. He wouldn't dress up as a princess.
Hey,
in my college. You know, make use of the little time that you have with your kids. I remember a sister telling me one time I was complaining about, the people that raise their hands and have all the elementary, middle school, high school age kids. You know, all the car time you have, you know, you're going to baseball and you're going to ballet and you're dropping them here at the friend's house. And I was complaining one time about all the time I spent just hauling the kids around in the car. And she said, that's precious time. You need to be using that time. You need to be talking with your children during that time. You know, and all I was doing was enduring that time. But I started doing that. I started changing it and making sure that we were having conversations. And I was asking them how their friendships were going and how they were feeling about things. And, you know, so use the little times as well. You know, if you have to go to the store, put one of those kids in the car with you, you know, and stop at Starbucks and get some coffee or, you know, something more healthier than that. But, you know, do something with those times that you have to just be about life's business. You know, I think one of the things we have to do in order to have a great relationship with our kids is we have to be willing to talk to our kids about everything. Everything. And I'm going to read just real quickly a very familiar scripture that I love. In Deuteronomy 6, it says, "Hear, O Israel, the Lord our God, the Lord is one. Love the Lord your God with all your heart and with all your soul and with all your strength. These commandments that I give you today are to be upon your hearts. Impress them on your children. Talk about them when you sit at home and when you walk along the road, when you lie down and when you get up." And I love this scripture because it talks about just having this daily, ongoing, intimate conversation with your kids about everything, about everything. About life, about God, about their dreams, about what you believe, about everything, hobbies, everything, you know. And you have to work sometimes to develop that kind of communication with your kids. You know, it doesn't just come automatically. It just doesn't come naturally sometimes. You know, sometimes I think, your kids may bring up things. There shouldn't be any taboo subjects. Michael and I are really, you know, adamantly feel like there should not be taboo subjects with your kids where you just say, we're not going to talk about that, you know. There are times that your kids are going to bring up subjects that you think, I'm not ready to talk with you about that right now. And I think that's fine to tell them, you know, you're not old enough yet, honey, but we'll talk about it. You and I will talk about it when you're old enough, but you're not old enough right now. But they need to know that they can come to you about everything, and that's what you want. You want them to come to you about everything. You know, sometimes this takes, again, a lot of effort on our part. I always talk about our two oldest children are 18 months apart, and so they were a year behind each other in school. So when they went to college, you know, they moved out of the house within 2 years, and we were left with Emily, who's the youngest, by 4 years. And just about that same time, she got her driver's license. So there was nobody home. Her brother and sister had left, and she had her driver's license. And she was a teen in the church. So you can imagine what happened. I mean, she was gone all the time. She was gone doing great stuff, you know, with the teens. But, you know, I realized when that happened, I thought, you know, we got to readjust things. I mean, it's not going to be like it was when Amanda and Robbie were home and everybody came home at the end of the afternoon. You know, Emily's off running around doing all this stuff. So I actually had to make a coffee date with her. And I said, once a week, we're going to meet at the local coffee place, Jittery Joe's, you know, and we're going to sit down and we're going to talk about you know, we're going to talk about your life, you know. And we did that every Thursday. I can't remember what the day was now. But once a week, we had a coffee day where, and it was like meeting one of the sisters. You know, it was on the calendar. And she loved that. And I heard more stuff about her life and her concerns and her worries and her struggles and her faith during that coffee date than I ever did at home, you know, because it was our special time. So sometimes you have to do some extra special things like that with a child. You know, I think sharing our beliefs, our faith with our kids needs to be just a part of this. You know, we're going to talk about family devotionals and things like that later on. But it should be this daily, you know, God should come up all the time in our conversations with our kids. You know, it shouldn't just be this set apart, you know, oh, we're doing family devotional on Monday, and that's the only time we talk about what we believe. You know, you should be doing that all the time as you have these conversations with your kids. You know, one of the other things I think we need to do is we need to make sure that our homes are a refuge from the world.
Amen.
And not a replica of the world.
Amen.
You know, your home should be a safe, enjoyable,
yes,
clean, fun, relaxed place for everybody in the family. For everybody in the family. You know, your kids should want to come home and be at home. That should be a great place for them to be. You know, if we're arguing, if we're bitter, if we're angry, Michael's going to talk about later on, if there's unresolved conflicts in our homes, it's not going to be that way.
No.
You know, if your living room looks like an episode of Jerry Springer, you got major work to do, okay?
Yeah.
There's major problems. You know, we always say that kids are like little emotional radars. It's amazing to us, the kids we see in the office. You know, even little tiny kids, I mean, we see, you know, 3-4-year-olds. They may not know exactly what's going on, but they pick up something's going on at home. They pick up. If there's a problem in the home, they know about it.
Oh, yeah.
So don't fool yourself. If you've got some stuff, you know, in your family that you need to deal with, you need to get busy trying to deal with it. You know, I have to mention marriage here a little bit. I am amazed when I talk with couples, even Christian couples sometimes, and I talk with them and they tell me we have this major marital problem that we're not dealing with and it's bad, and but the kids don't know anything about it. You know, do not fool yourself. If you've got major marital problems, you need to deal with that first. You know, before you even worry about parenting problems.
Right.
You know, you need to fix your marriage first. The marriage is absolutely the foundation. You are not going to raise great kids if you have a marriage problem that you're not dealing with. You know, we need to do some things to establish a great family atmosphere. You know, it needs to be regular family times together. Things like dinner time, meal times together, which we're going to talk about a little bit more later in the day. Fun things to do, you know, family nights. You know, we used to have a family night on Friday night. Our rule at our house was we never ate dinner in front of the television. You know, that was not allowed. But on Friday night, it was allowed. And we had an old comforter that the kids called a picnic blanket, you know, that was stuffed in a closet somewhere. And they got to pull out the picnic blanket and put it in front of the TV. And we would, you know, order Domino's pizza or put in a frozen pizza if we didn't have the money. And put in a Disney movie or something that everybody chose. And we'd all sit on the picnic blanket together and eat dinner and watch a movie together. The kids thought that was wonderful. They loved family night. You know, it cost nothing. You know, it didn't make a mess because we put picnic blanket down, you know. But do something like that with your kids, you know, where you have a regular, fun family time together. You know, things like birthdays and holidays and vacations need to be great for your kids. You know, we also need to, every time you get a chance, you need to expose your kids to God's Word,
yes,
to His Word. Use the Bible with your kids. You know, use the Bible to correct your children.
Right.
Use the Bible to encourage your children. When they're having a hard time with friends at school, find some scriptures to encourage them. You know, pull out the Bible and use it with your kids. It's amazing to me. I remember times that we would, you know, correct one of our kids over and over and over again about something. And then we would pull out the Bible and we would say, let me show you what the Bible says about this. you know, this is so much more powerful than anything we could say to our kids. You know, it has the same effect on them than it does on us if we'll just use it, you know, but we've got to be using it with them. You know, I think about my own parents. I had great parents. I had great moral, strict parents that protected me from a lot. But a lot of rules I had growing up, I knew were just made up. You know, I knew it was just what Mom and Dad thought. You know, that didn't have a great impact on me. You know, that didn't make a big influence on me. I think it's so different for our kids to know this is not just what Dad thinks. This is what God thinks about what's going on in your life. This is what God thinks. You know, use the Bible to give them kind of a vision of who they could be in the future. You know, with each of our kids, we had a Bible story that we said, this person in the Bible reminds me of you. You know, when Robbie was growing up, he was short for, until he got into high school, he was about that big. I mean, he was just real short little guy. And so David and Goliath, he loved the story of David and Goliath, you know. And we would tell him, you know, you could be like David. That's something you could do. You could be like him. You know, with Amanda, our girly girl, it was Esther. She loved the story of Esther, you know. Our other girl, who was not a girly girl at all, it was Deborah. You know, she thought that was a cool story, that Deborah got to lead the army. You know, that's definitely Emily, if you ever meet Emily. You know, that's the kind of girl she is. You know, pick out a Bible character and say, that's who you remind me of. You're like this person in a lot of ways. You could be like this someday. You know, keep your kids coming to church as long as you possibly can. Keep them coming to church and church activities. I want to just encourage you a little bit. We, I guess about 5 years ago now, Sam and Jerry Lang came up with this crazy idea. We had a teen leader that left. And they came up with this crazy idea that Michael and I, at the ripe old age of 50, should lead the teens, you know? And so, you know, we met with them and we explained to them, you know, thank you so much for thinking of us, but we absolutely will not do that. And they said, great, start on Wednesday. So we led the teens for about 2 years, which was a great experience, actually. It was a great experience. But one of the things we noticed is there was about 3 or 4 families that religiously dropped off their 15, 16-year-old boys. And they would sit in the back of the class like this, you know. Kids that were raised in church, they'd heard it all before. And literally, I mean, that's about what you got from them, sitting in the back of the teen class. I'm trying to think. I think all of those boys are disciples now. Almost all of those boys, we just baptized one last week, so almost all of those boys that sat in the back of the teen class like that are disciples now. Some of them didn't do it until they got away from home and were in college, you know, but that there's an influence there, and as long as you can expose them to it, please do that. Please do that. You know, make every effort to keep them around spiritual friends. I'll talk again about Robbie. You'll hear a lot about Robbie today because he just had interesting stories growing up. His stories were more interesting. But when he was in high school, he was the only disciple in the teen ministry, the only boy disciple in the teen ministry. All of the friends he grew up with were not interested at all at that point in being disciples. And the high school that he went to, when he let it be known that he was a Christian, the other boys in the high school decided to make those 4 years the hardest years of his life. You know, they gave him all kinds of grief about not being sexually active and everything. I mean, it was miserable. And so when he got to driving age, he had a couple of boys that he had met at church camp that lived in Gwinnett, which is about 30 minutes from our house. And when he got his driver's license, we got him a little car, and literally on Friday afternoon when school was over, we would put Robbie in that car. We would send him off 30 miles up the road. There were about 3 families on the other end that would house him for the weekend. And he got to be around some other brothers, you know. And he would spend the weekend with these 3 or 4 guys, you know, in Atlanta. And on Sunday afternoon, they would bring, you know, he'd come back home and we'd start the week over again. That's how he made it through high school spiritually. That's how he made it through high school. And, it, you know, it's interesting, in December, you know, if I showed you a picture of Robbie's wedding party, all those boys are in it. You know, those are the boys that stood up with him when he got married. You know, do that for your kids. Do that for your kids. Drive, pay for the gas, arrange with another family. Do that for your kids. You know, get your kids to any kind of Christian activity that you can get them to. You know, we're lucky in Athens. We are so lucky because we have a church camp. We have the swamp, you know, that the kids go to in the summertime. And it costs money. It costs, you know, $280 to send a kid to the camp. We had three kids, and we sent them 2 weeks a summer when they were growing up, every summer. And my Jewish husband complained about every check to the swamp. Complained about it. Every summer, riding the check. You know, there. You know, we don't regret one penny of that right now. We will not regret one penny of that. So, write the check. Send them on.
Come on, all right? I was just being a good steward. It's true. That was the greatest investment I could think of. We're going to take a little break. When we come back, we're going to just give you some more practical things. We're going to talk about building character. We're going to talk about communication a little bit more. And lastly, we're going to talk about the big kahuna, which is discipline. I just want to say before we take a break, just remember, as kids grow older, whether or not they become Christians, they're going to hold on to the things they've been taught by you. And if they don't become disciples, there will be something. The word doesn't come back void. You will have planted something in them. And like I said, you may not see, you may be dead before they become disciples. You know, I mean, literally, you might pass away and they become disciples when they're 80. Who knows, you know? The point is, you might not see it now, but it may happen later on. And you don't know the outcome of your kids' lives. So let's take a 10-minute break. Don't go too far, and then we'll talk again. What we're going to talk about next are really two things, two different topics. We're going to talk about communication, effective communication, and then we're going to talk about building character. Now, these two topics have absolutely nothing in common except for they both start with the letter C, so that's all I can think of.
Building character.
One thing I think we could all use help on is how to communicate with our kids. And, you know, it's like Joel said, Mary and I, if you add up our total years in psychology, it's something like 50 years, and there's one thing I've learned, which is now number two. If parents could learn, would be willing to, and could learn how to communicate better with their kids, it would do away with a significant number of child behavior problems, and she and I would be out of a job. So don't get too good at this, okay? Because we've got to make a living. We're looking forward to retirement. It's a little place on the beach we're looking at. So if you would like to support us, miscommunicate with your kids, I'm good with that. But in theory, let's talk about effective communication. What is that? Probably the best way to describe it is talk first about what ineffective communication is. Think about it. In a typical household, even a disciple household, the majority of interactions between a parent and a child are either an order or a command or an interrogation, right? You're either telling the kid to do something or you're asking them the litany of parenting questions. Pick that up, or you're saying, put that away, or where have you been, or who did this? Or possibly the most useless question in the language of a parent, why did you do this? That may be the world's most useless question to get to a child. I don't know. Oh, well, you don't know, huh? Well, you better know. That's a hard... It's a really hard answer to refute. Most of the time, think about this. When a parent communicates with a child, it's to make the parent's life more convenient, right? You're saying, be quiet, pick this up, do this or do that. It's really to make your life more convenient. That's ineffective communication, although some of that is necessary. Effective godly scriptural communication does three things. Its purpose is to teach, to train, or to establish a relationship. That's what effective communication should be. It's to teach, train, or establish a relationship. Ineffective communication is when you're just trying to make your life more easy. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
That's an important point. You know, ineffective communication is really easy for us. It's natural for us. How did we learn such a good job of being ineffective communicators? Let's blame it on our parents again. Our own parents. You know, like I said, you either emulate your parents or you do the opposite of what they did. And that establishes this legacy. So, Lenny, I'm glad I got the dads here, because we're going to talk to you about what dads can do. And then Mary's going to talk to the moms, so don't think your wives are getting out of this, okay? Yeah. Let's talk about some dad things, and dad-specific ineffective communication things. Some of you guys were raised by, and subsequently are now, yellers, right? Or scream. Not old yeller. I mean, you're like yellers. Yellers have this theory, this mathematical equation, that volume equals obedience. And the more your volume, the more likely the child is to obey, right? If you were raised by a dad like that, how did that make you feel? You either felt frightened or intimidated or angry, right? Most likely, you didn't like it. And to this day, to some extent, you might still feel that way when someone raises their voice, you know? When your spouse does, or your boss, or even your own child, it brings back all those memories and you feel frightened, intimidated, or most likely angry. When you're yelled at, you can only do three things as a child. You only got three options. You can obey out of fear and then resent the parent. Some of you did that. That's number one. You can totally shut the parent out. That's number two. Totally ignore that parent. Or number three, you can dig in your heels and you can match yell for yell, scream for scream, volume for volume, which is the worst thing because that only escalates, sometimes to the point where it becomes physical. We don't want that. Now, there are other wrong ways to communicate just beside yelling and screaming and intimidating. I'll confess that in my house, the way my sense of humor is, if you haven't gotten this idea already, my tendency is to be sarcastic. Very sarcastic. And sometimes in the name of being funny, I'll make a sarcastic comment. And I remember, as I think back to when my kids are little, I remember every time I did that, and I could see it in that child's face, that it hurt the child's feelings. That I remember. And I had to come to convictions that sarcasm is just hurt disguised as humor, right? And what's really funny is now I've got three really sarcastic kids. And I say in my family we exchange sarcasm like it's a form of currency, you know. I mean, we're a very sarcastic family. And sometimes, especially with Robbie, who's my little stunt double, you know, he'll say something really sarcastic. I'm like, man, rein that in. And then I think, where did he learn that? And here I am correcting. Sometimes he's sarcastic with his wife, and I say, what? Where'd you get that? And he looks at me sarcastically and says, gee, Dad, I don't know. So I have got to ride shotgun on my sarcasm to this very day, you know, and I'm seeing it in my own kids. It's like, oh my goodness, look what I've done, you know. But that can be curved in, and I have to rein it in. I have to rein it in them sometimes. Another thing that dads do, so there's yelling, there's sarcasm. Here's another thing, is trying to communicate while you're distracted, which really is no communication at all. And I'm not talking about like you're watching TV or you're listening to the ball game distracted. I'm talking about you're looking at them and you're talking to them, but you're thinking about something else. Your business or your boss or stuff you got to do today or stuff you did yesterday. You know, I'm talking about being distracted in your mind, you know. Or even you're thinking about something fun, you know. Boy, I can't wait to, you know, get on my motorcycle today, so I'll contest that one. Now, Ephesians 6:4 says, "Fathers, do not exasperate your children. Instead, bring them up in the training and instruction of the Lord." Each of these forms of miscommunication, the yelling, the being sarcastic, the being distracted, are exasperating to a child. Because they either demean this child, or they make him feel like he's got no way out, right? The yelling is very, you know, "I've got no way out of this." That's what exasperation is. The result of that is insecurity. We don't want insecure kids. Like I said before, the human ego, the most fragile thing in the world. All we have to do is be sarcastic once or yell once, and it'll make a dent in your kid's psyche that could last for years. I mean, that's just the way the human being is. So the way you communicate to your child can make literally the difference between a lifetime of insecurity and a lifetime of confidence. Those seeds are sown by the way you as dads communicate with your kids, especially dads to daughters, for example.
Can we talk a little bit about the why?
Yes, we're going to let Mary talk a little bit about helping your wives with this.
I'm going to go through what I'm going to be talking to the women about this afternoon. And this morning I was asking Michael, I said, "What are we going to do with that whole section?" And he said, "Well, go ahead and go through it so that the men know what the women are hearing, for one thing." And yeah, what he said also, though, is some of the men may be guilty of some of these things as well. So I'll let you take that for what it's worth. You know, I do think as women, I mean, we can do the you know, yelling and stuff like that too, but I think we have some unique challenges in communication sometimes. You know, one is just being too busy as moms. You know, and Michael talked about this a little bit with being distracted, but, you know, it's so easy, I think, to get caught up in the housework and the daily routine and getting kids to school and the, you know, getting to church and blah, 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 blah. And you don't really ever have a meaningful exchange with your child, you know. So, you know, I think we just have to be really careful about that happening. You know, I think another problem is just with your tone of voice. You can shut down communication with your tone of voice with your child. I tell the story all the time. In our house, we are lucky enough to have kind of a finished basement. It's just kind of a big bonus room and a full bath. And when the kids were little, we had a whole string of single sisters that lived in the basement for room and board. It just helps out with the kids a little bit, which was a great blessing to our family. Great blessing to our family to have those girls. And one of the things that we did right when we had the sisters move in is we would sit them down and say, "We really want you guys to tell us what you see happening in our family, in our home, what we're doing wrong." You know, and, you know, you're not a mom, you don't have kids, and, you know, but you know the Bible, and you know what we're supposed to look like. And if we don't look like that, we would really appreciate you telling us about that, since you're going to be living with us. Some of the girls lived with us even for a couple of years. So anyway, one of the sisters one time came up into the kitchen. My kids were, Amanda was probably seven, maybe 6 or 7 years old, and the other ones were under her. And Amanda was a very demanding little girl. She is a wonderful grown-up woman, but she was a very demanding little girl. She was very high energy. She talked all the time,
like me.
Constantly. She's one of those kids that you constantly had to give her your attention, and so she was a tough little kid to live with. Anyway, this one sister came up one evening after dinner and set me down at the kitchen table and started getting teary-eyed and said, "I really don't want to tell you this, and, you know, but I have to tell you that every time you talk to Amanda, it sounds different than when you talk to the other two kids, and you always sound angry at her. You always sound like you're irritated with her." And that was hard for me to hear because I knew she was 100% correct, because I felt irritated with her. And I had to work on, you know, saying things to Amanda like this, you know, in a sweet voice, you know. But I am so grateful for that input because, you know, Amanda and I are best friends. We are best friends. I talk to her 3 times a day, usually, you know. It would not be like that if I hadn't gotten that kind of input, you know. So let people even hear how your family interacts. Encourage somebody to tell you what they hear in your home. You know, sometimes we'll tell people, you know, put a recording device on. You know, do that someday and see what your home sounds like. You know, because that's what your kids are growing up in. You know. You know, one of the things I think as moms that we love to do is we love to nag our kids. Nag. You know, pick up your room, say it 10 times. You know, dads can be guilty of this too. Actually, I'll tell on Michael a little bit. In our house, it was Michael that was more than, he picked. We called it picking. You know, and especially if he was anxious about something that was going, like at the office, he was worried about billing in the office or something like that. He would come home and he would start saying things. You know, we would have little kids, you know, all these little kids eating at the table. And he would say, "You're dropping bread on the floor. You're dropping," you know, and I'm thinking, they're little kids. Of course they're dropping bread on the floor. So, you know, we talked about it, you know, and because it was affecting his relationship with the kids. And we actually made a little sign where I would give him a little signal to let him know, "You're picking at the kids," you know. So you may have to do this, you know. You may have to ask for wives. Let's make a little hand signal where you can tell me when you see me doing that. Or you may need to do that with her. You may need to help her. And that was one of the things I told Michael, you know, one of the things I would really like to encourage the brothers to do is when you hear your wives doing this, help them with it. Help them with it. You know, there would be times that I would be, you know, at the kids about something, and Michael would come and say, "You know, Mary, that's enough. That's enough." And I knew that was my signal to, it was time for mommy to take a time out, you know. But if that's helpful, if you can get that kind of partnership as parents, you know, do whatever you have to do to keep from ruining communication with your kids in this way. The last thing that I wanted to talk about is just being overly controlling with our kids. You know, when our kids are 2 years old, we tell them where to sit and what to eat and when to go to bed and what to wear. And, you know, sometime between 2 and 20, that should stop.
Right.
You know? But it doesn't always. We don't, you know, it doesn't always. And you will find yourself saying things to your kids that are totally age inappropriate, you know, that you shouldn't be controlling. You know, a 17-year-old boy in your home, you should not be controlling what he eats. I mean, if it's reasonable. You know what I mean? You shouldn't be telling him every bite that he puts into his mouth. You know, Robbie, and you'll hear later on, Robbie was not our best student growing up. He's a great student now, but he was not then. And so we got in this habit of, you know, always haranguing him about his homework and his schoolwork and stuff like that. And about 6 months ago, he came over to the house, and it was about homework time. You know, it was about 4 o'clock in the afternoon, 4 or 5 in the afternoon, and I'm cooking, and he's standing in the kitchen. And I turn to my 23-year-old married son and say, "Do you have homework, honey?" And, you know, luckily he very calmly looked at me and he said, "How old am I, Mom?" And I thought, you know, but we do that kind of stuff. We do it. You know, it's in the parent's handbook to do those controlling things. But there's nothing, if you're a very controlling parent, mom or dad, there is nothing that will ruin your relationship with your kids quicker than that. You know, they do have free will, and we've got to let them grow up and choose some things along the way.
Amen. Oh, yeah, you can clap for her after she confesses my sin. Let's reinforce that, shall we? Thank you, dear. Time will come. We have the afternoon left. Let's talk about a few ways to facilitate communication. Now, Mary talked about a bunch of them earlier. Ways, this is what you have to keep in mind. Kids aren't like little sophisticated mini adults, you know? They haven't learned how to label their feelings and process things. Heck, a bunch of you haven't learned how to do that. So you can't sit down and talk to them, you know, you can't interrogate them, you can't interview them like, you know, like a talk show host or something, you know. I have a couch in my office, But I tell parents, if I'm going to see a kid regularly in therapy for a time, I say, I'm not going to have him come in and lay on this couch, you know? We're going to... This Mary talked about having one-to-one time. Once again, that's something you have to do to make... It's got to be something enjoyable to the child. And when you do that, you'll be amazed at how they will open up. If you're doing something that's fun for that child. In our office, if you ever come to our office, we've got one room that is floor to ceiling. When the kids walk in, it's full of games. It's just a bunch of games and Legos, and we've got Play-Doh, we've got crayons, we've got all these games. And sometimes we'll just start by playing a game. Now, I tell kids when I see them in therapy, I said, let's play a game, but we're going to talk while we're playing the game. And you'd be, if they're doing something that interests them, you'd be surprised how. The problem is this. There's like three games that kids just love better than any other game. Guess Who? You know what that is? Candyland. And Uno. And there's some days I think, if I have to play another Candyland, I'm going to take a fork and stick it in my eye. And I have to tell you, one day we're playing. I was playing Candyland for the 18th time that day. I mean, I'll say, pick any game you want. In my head, I'm going, please don't pick Guess Who. Please don't pick Guess Who. And they go, I want to play Guess Who. And I'd go, great. So I was playing Candyland one day, and I'm looking at Mr. Mint. And he's in a forest of peppermint sticks. He's got an axe. And I'm thinking, the axe head is made out of mint. Now, don't they know that if you try to cut down a candy cane with something that's the same density as a candy cane, it's not going to work? And now I'm thinking, whoa. All right. I've been playing this too long. Honest to goodness, when they revised Kent, they recently, Milton Bradley came up with a new edition of it, and Queen Faustine is no longer a queen, she's a princess. And Princess Lolly is no longer royalty, she's Lolly. And I'm like, what's up with this? Was there a coup in Candyland? Did they overthrow the government? And I literally, this no joke, I wrote to Milton Bradley. I was just curious. I told him, I said, dear Milton Bradley, I play Candyland 87 times a day. And I couldn't help but notice, they wrote me back and they told me this. They said they thought that a little girl, couldn't relate to a queen as much as to a princess. So they made it Princess Frostine. I was like, okay, that makes sense. The point is this. If you think willingly I would play Candyland that many times a day, I can no longer. All right, one more little story. On Guess Who, you know how Guess Who, you're trying to guess who the other person's person is by appearances, you know, and you say, does your person have a hat on? Is your person wearing glasses? Does your person have gray hair? Sometimes I get so bored. I'll ask the kid something like, does your person have an allergy to milk products? Or is your person from Wisconsin? I love it because the kids go, some kids go, I don't know. At that point, I know that more evaluation is necessary. The point is this. All kids, if you arrange time to attend to them one-to-one and you do something they like, as torturous it may be, they will open up to you. Let me talk about one more super important thing of how to facilitate communication. There's some interesting research that just came out about family mealtimes, the importance of family mealtimes. And this research said that families that eat together, dinner together, at least several times each week, the kids, if you hold all things, other things equal, the kids are likely to have higher grades in school, lower rates of drug and alcohol abuse, and they're less likely to engage in early sexual experience or delinquent activities. Just the act of sitting down as a family and having a family time together. Now, this was a multivariate study. That means they looked at a million other things. socioeconomic status of the parents, race, intelligence, geographical location, all those things. Whether or not the parents were still married, whether or not they had religious convictions, of all those things, the one thing that had the most influence on the kids being delinquents or not later on was, did they have family meal times together? How simple is that? So we, you know, and it gets harder as your kids get older because they have soccer and wrestling and ballet and stuff like that. And you have to, so it's not a perfect, you don't have to be perfect 7 days a week. It just says if you do it a couple of times a week, family mealtime, no television, that you get all those benefits. How easy is that? So that's one way to facilitate communication. Let me add something about family times. What do we call them? Family Bible study time.
Devotionals.
Thank you. That shows how important they are to me. Those things, you know, they're really important. Our kids were never good at the family Devo. You know, we're friends with like the Jacobies. You know, Doug and Vicky Jacoby. They're probably here selling books. You know, their idea of family time was, we all get together and we recite in the original Latin, you know, 8 chapters from Deuteronomy. They, you know, they could do that. We couldn't do that. Try as we might, we go to these parenting seminars and get hints on how to have a family devo. And we'd set our little kids down and we'd try to sing something and then we'd try to do a scripture. And, you know, in 5 minutes, one of them's pushing the other and they're fighting with each other. And then I'm getting mad, wrecking the whole thing by yelling at them. So early on, we figured that in our family, the traditional family devo didn't work, you know. So we did a couple of things. One is I'd have a little bullet devo in the morning before the kids went to school. So they'd get, you know, their teeth are brushed, their hair's brushed. We'd sit for 2 minutes in my study. We'd pick a scripture and we'd talk about it, and that's it. You're out of here. Or when we had these family dinner times, that was a good time to have a family devo because they were captive. They were captive audience. You want to eat, you got to deal with this. So we pick a topic or a subject or a scripture and we just bounce it around. It didn't have to be any fancy pre-study thing, you know. We just talk about it. What happened was after time, the kids liked it so much that one day one of them asked Mary, does Dad always have to lead the Devo? Can one of us do it? We're like, yeah, go for it. Then after a while, they were fighting over who would lead the Devo. And they were very creative, much more creative than I ever was. They'd think of stuff to illustrate their points, you know. So it was great. That turned a whole family dinner into a great way to communicate. So you do that, you make the, like Mary said, opportunities out of short periods to talk, and you got it. That's an easy thing to do. Mary's going to talk a little bit about nonverbal communication, I think.
I'm going to go off the notes a little bit, but this is something Michael and I have talked about a lot, and I feel like I would be remiss in this room not to mention this because I've heard this so much, and I'm going to try to just share with you some of the things I've heard sitting in my office, even in Christian families, even from Christian families, and I really just want to implore you, brothers, if you have an anger problem and you are controlling your home by anger, please, please get help with that. Please grab another brother today and say, I am angry at my house. I have had wives crying in my office over the anger of their husbands, Christian husbands. I have sat with especially girls, especially daughters, in tears over how angry their dad is at home. And what it is doing to their family. Please, if this is an issue for you, if this is a sin you're tempted with, get help. Do whatever you have to do because it will destroy your family. A lot of these families, I'll be honest with you, a lot of these families ended up, the couples ended up divorcing. The children ended up leaving God over this issue. It is huge.
Wow.
So, you know, while we're talking about communication, I feel like if I don't talk about anger, I'd be remiss. Okay, we're going to move on to nonverbal communication. You know, we only express only part of our communication is verbal. And sometimes it's the least important part. Nonverbal communication is very important. And we're talking about things like being physically affectionate with your kids. You know, there's actual psychological research that says the amount of affection that a girl gets from her father determines whether or not she's going to be sexually active as a teenager or not.
Wow.
Now, I know you guys are all going to go home and your daughter's like this. Tell them I'm sorry about that. Okay? You know, but, you know, there's research that says that. You know, it is very important, you know, just touching our kids, hugging our kids. And it gets harder as they get older. I mean, it's easy with two-year-olds. You know, you take the little two-year-old and you put them up in your lap and you rock them and you hug them, you know. 12-year-old boys, you pretty much have to run them down and tackle them, you know. And it's a little scary to get too close to them. But, you know, we've got to figure out a way to give our kids that physical affection or they're going to be getting it someplace else. They'll get it someplace else. You know, there are other things like eye contact. You know, if you and I as adults talk to each other, we're going to look in each other's eyes. But, you know, you think about, especially at home with your kids, 90% of our communication is kind of over the shoulder while we're doing something else, you know, to put something down and turn around and talk to your kids face to face is huge, you know, and we've got to make sure that we're doing that, that we're giving them that kind of attention. Like Michael said, you know, sometimes people will ask us, you know, how do you get kids to talk to you in therapy? You know, how do you get the kids to talk to you? And the secret is it's not hard at all because most kids don't get one-to-one individual close attention from a grown-up ever. And so we bring them into our office, we put out Candyland, and we sit across the table from them. And we listen to what they say face-to-face with rapt attention for 1 hour. They'll tell us everything. They'll tell us everything. That doesn't happen. It doesn't happen in school. It doesn't happen in most of the homes, you know. So we've got to make sure that we're really engaging our kids in that way. You know, tell them, directly communicate to them what you like about them. They need to hear it, you know, and not just, you're a great kid. You know, they need to hear, this is your strengths as a person. This is your strengths. We don't talk a lot about self-esteem in these workshops, you know, but these are the things that help a child have a sober estimate of themselves. I like that better than self-esteem. I have some issues with the self-esteem thing, but anyway, we won't get into that. You know, we want our children to have a sober estimate of themselves. We want them to know that God gave you these gifts. And this is why you are a great person, a wonderful person. These are the things you need to build on. By the same token, in our family, we call them favorite sins. They need to know what their favorite sins are. They need to know what they are tempted with. You know, Amanda, God bless her little heart, by the time she was 4, knew what the word manipulative meant, you know, because that was her favorite sin. You know, we would walk in the room, the other two kids would be duking it out, Amanda would be sitting there like a little angel, and it was her fault, you know? It was, because that's what she did, is she was very manipulative with people. She knew that word, and we talked to her a lot about that, you know, that, you can, that this is something, this is a favorite sin you've got to work on. With the other kids, it was different things. You know, but that needs to be an open part of communication in your house. Is what sins are you most tempted with? You know, how is Satan going to take you down if he takes you down? And we need to be open with ourselves in that, I think. You know, as parents, our kids need to know what our favorite sins are as well. It's interesting, Michael was talking about our family devotionals. And some of the ones when the kids took over, it was kind of like group sharing time, you know. And I remember one was... where we went around and each person told another person what they thought they needed to work on spiritually. That was an interesting family devotion. You know, that was, you know, we all went home with homework after that one, you know. But you need to have those kind of time. You know, your kids need to be able to communicate with you in a respectful manner what they see in your life as well. I guess that's it. Thank you.
We're going to go really fast through the topic of building character because I want to have plenty of time to talk about discipline. That always seems to be the big topic. So we're going to not gracefully segue into the topic of building character. Now, I want to make a distinction between three things: personality, heart, and character. They're different things. You know, there are some things about a person's personality that can be shaped and changed. Thank goodness, or else my wife would have thrown me out years ago. There are some things in your personality that you can change and you can shape and mold. There are some aspects of personality, though, that are inborn. They're God-given. They're hardwired, like a computer. You know, and you know you have kids like that, because how many times has it happened that your kids have done something irritating or interesting, and you say, I don't know why he's like that. He's been that way since birth. I'm sure you've said those very words. Or, for those of you who have more than one kid, you look at your kids and you say, these three grew up under the same roof, did they not? They share the same gene pool, do they not? Yet they're like completely different creatures. It was definitely that way with our three kids. It's because of this element of everyone's personality that's not shaped by the environment, the hardwired thing, that we call temperament. The hardwired parts of your personality are called temperament. And we see this all the time in the office and dealing with Christian parents. Parents that come in and say, what did I do wrong? The parents say, how did this happen? What did I do wrong? And a lot of times I say, you didn't do anything wrong. What you're seeing here is your child's temperament. It's this part of his personality that you can't control. It's hardwired. Well, if that's true, why are we having this discussion at all? If there's some parts of your kids that you can change, because there are aspects of a child's personality that are inalterable, but you can mold their character, what we're going to call character. Character is really a fancy word for the collection of morals and values that a person chooses to adopt, and the way that person puts those morals and values into practice. I'll say it again in case you're taking notes. Character is a word for the collection of morals and values that a person chooses to adopt, and the way that person puts those values into practice. Sometimes we use the term heart, but that's different too. I've seen plenty of kids in my office who have done atrocious things. And the parent says to me, yeah, but you know, deep down, he really has a good heart. And I believe that. I think that's true. Often I'm in perfect agreement that there is a difference between heart. Heart is your moral compass. Character is your willingness to obey that moral compass when it comes to your own behavior. Heart is your moral compass. Character is your willingness to obey that moral compass. With that in mind, let's talk about some biblical standards we have to teach our kids in order for them to develop strong character. Now, let me give you a warning, though, first. You may agree with everything we're about to say with these biblical principles of character, but if you're not willing to obey them yourself, your kids are going to know it. Kids have this incredible hypocrisy radar. They can sniff out a hypocrite in 2 seconds, and they will use that against you. How dare you make me try to live that way when you're doing this, or you're doing that, or you're not doing this? They have highly sensitive hypocrisy radar. So if you're not obeying these God's rules that we're going to talk about yourself, your kids are going to know it, and it's just going to turn into another resentment or another point of conflict. The first one I want to talk about is obedience to authority. We have to teach our kids that, like it or not, everyone is under authority. You're under the authority of your parents first, and when you get older, you're under the authority of your boss. Even when you're self-employed like I am, you're under someone's authority, the government, the police, whatever. In Romans 13, it tells us to obey all earthly authority, doesn't it? It also says if you trust God, earthly authority won't have any fear for you. So we want to teach our kids to obey authority. I am an inveterate speeder. Okay, I'll admit it. I had to learn through the school of hard knocks and paying many speeding fines not to do that anymore. So I have shaped my outward behavior of obedience to traffic authority, I still have to change my heart. Because Mary invented a term for me, literally on the ride to the airport to come out here. She said, "You need help with your vehicular Christianity." And in that, she meant, I am willing to now obey, submit to the authority of the traffic police, but I still am a little salty with my language, you know. And I said this is after the eighth person cut in front of me and went too slow or too fast or something like that. And I unload some choice words. Mary calls this vehicular Christianity. So I'm going to repent. I'm going to work on that. But in terms of obeying the authority, paying out enough speeding fines did that. So we want to teach our kids to obey authority by submitting to earthly authorities ourselves and showing them by example. Let me use my mom as an example again. She never let us speak ill of the government, my mother. She had opinions, I know. She worked for the government for 30 years as a mental health, community mental health nurse. She had opinions about the government. She never let us speak ill of the president or those in government. She taught us to respect them because they are appointed, duly appointed. You know, that's the kind of thing. Now, I'm not saying don't turn your kids into non-thinking, non-critical people, but we speak respectfully about our leaders. Now, if you've noticed in America, a lot of parents have decided that the rights of the children come before anything, including earthly authority. If a kid gets in trouble at school, a lot of these parents are the first to get in the face of the teacher or the principal or argue about it, or they try to find someone else to blame. That drives us nuts in the office. We see parents, in the interest of defending their kids, they go and they get in the face of the teacher. And I end up saying to the parent, you're not doing him any service here, you know. He's going to have bad teachers. He's going to have bad bosses. He's going to have bad roommates. No, that doesn't count because they're not in authority. Bad landlords. You know, they've got to learn to work with these people and submit to their authority. You know what really drives me nuts is when this happens on the athletic field. Dads. I'm not a... Joel mentioned that I'm a martial artist. I'm not a ball sport guy. You know, my kids played t-ball and stuff like that. I'm not that. I just went to have fun. You know, I wasn't in the faces of the officials. What I do, you know, I take and teach taekwondo and I officiate at tournaments. What drives me nuts is a parent... If you've ever been to a taekwondo tournament, you have a ring, and you have three judges. The reason we have three judges is to not miss anything. There's me, the center judge, and two corner judges. And we don't just sit there. We move around. We get our faces in there to see what's going on. So that when a point is called, it's by vote. You pull the judges. You either saw it, didn't see it, or it definitely wasn't a point. And you take a vote, and that point is awarded based on the consensus of the judges. That seems really fair to me. Now, we're not going to catch everything, I'll admit. You know, it's not a perfect thing. But I've seen parents get up from their seats in the bleachers and walk down. And in taekwondo, that ring is sacrosanct, man. You do not enter my house and tell me how to judge. And they will step onto my mat, my ring, and tell me I missed the point. I'm like, I'm going to kick you with a sidekick out of this ring. I can't believe it. And we teach the kids. We teach, hey, and those of us that judge, we're in tournaments ourselves. And I've had to bite my tongue, get a point scored against me, or one I made that wasn't scored. I submit to the judges. And I try to teach our students to do that. They are earthly authority. What's the worst thing that can happen? You lose the match, big deal. You won't remember this when you're older. This is an important lesson that dads especially to teach their kids. Now, I'm not saying to teach your kids to lay down if they've been treated unjustly. They have to learn to stick up for themselves, but they do it themselves, and they do it in a righteous and respectful way. Amen. That's what we can teach them. We're not helping them by yelling at the umpire or the referee or the line judge. I'd much rather have a kid learn the lesson of submitting to authority than to learn a harder lesson later on, which is authority is going to win. right?
Of course.
So when you do that, dads, you're missing a very important lesson opportunity.
Before we go on to our next topic, I'm just kind of an aside. During the break, we had one brother come up and ask if we were going to address stepfathers specifically at all or not. And we're not, actually, except to say that everything we've just taught is going to be 10 times harder if you're talking about being a step-parent. I mean, things like building relationships and, you know, it's hard. And depending on how the situation, you know, some situations vary, you know, on how difficult that is, you know, depending on how old the child is, what their relationship with their father is. But one thing I will say to stepdads is this whole issue of teaching your children respect for authority. If you become a step parent in a home, you are still a parent. That is a position of authority in the home. And the kids have got to be taught. Now, you may have a lot of feelings. You will have a lot of feelings to work through and all that kind of stuff, you know. But you're the parent in that home. You are still the parent in that home. So don't give away that authority, that God-given authority, too quickly. Okay, let me move on. I'm going to talk about teaching our children honesty and integrity. And really, if you think about it, I'm not sure there's an area of character that's any more important than this. Because if your kids are honest with you, you can pretty much help them through whatever they go through. If they are not honest with you, that is a barrier that keeps you as a parent from having influence on those areas of their lives that they're not telling you about. And this is an area, as Michael said before, that I think we teach first and foremost by our example. You know, if we are not people honest and people of integrity, our kids definitely are not going to be, you know, and you can give them scriptures and you can punish them for it. And, you know, but if you are being dishonest, your kids will be dishonest. You know, so first we have to address it in ourselves first if we want our kids to have this in their character. The other way I think that we teach honesty is we need to make lying a big deal in our homes, a big, memorable deal. It needs to be a sin that kind of goes on to another level that you deal with. Because, again, we can't help our kids if they're not being honest with us. You know, never let a lie go by, even a small one. And I think the earlier we teach this, the easier it's going to be, obviously. You know, all kids lie. All kids lie. They're going to try it. You know, we just need to let them know that this is a major thing, even if it's about something small. We have a very famous lie story in the Shapiro house, and it involves Henry Kramer's son-in-law. We didn't call him our son during this episode. when Robbie was left elementary school and went to middle school, he did well in elementary school, moved into middle school, and he kind of decided that he had had enough formal education. That was all he needed. 5 years is plenty. So, you know, about 6 weeks go by, and we get a call from one of the teachers saying, you know, Robbie's a pleasant kid, and he's very obedient, and but he hadn't turned in a lick of work since he got here. So, you know, like good parents, and, you know, we have PhDs, and so, of course, what we start doing is grilling him every night when he comes home at the dinner table. You know, how are you doing in English? Well, I'm not doing that well in English. You know, how are you doing in math? Well, I didn't pass that test. And, you know, we go through this day after day after day. And one night at the dinner table, he said, well, I'm doing really well in Spanish because I got Spaniard of the Week. And we were like, yes, that's great, son. You know, maybe you can work at McDonald's in Spain. That's wonderful. Grasping at straws. Any kind of good news at this point, you know. So anyway, about a week, we get called into the teacher's meeting. And have you guys been to the teacher's meetings? You know, you go to the table. There's 5 teachers sitting around the table. You're at the end, you know. And so we go around the table, and the English teacher says, you know, we love Robbie, but he's not working up to his potential. And the math teacher says, you know, he's really struggling in my class. And so we sit there, and we hear all of this, and we get around to the very end, and the little Spanish teacher is sitting at the end. And Michael says, well, at least we know he's doing well in your class. And she said, oh, really? And he said, yeah, because he got Spaniard of the Week. And she said, what's that? You know, it's only funny because it's 10 years later. That's why it's funny. And for those of you who have middle school boys, this same boy just graduated from college with honors, so don't kill them yet, all right? They do grow out of it. But let me tell you, I mean, we were so obviously upset when we left that meeting that I had two teachers off of that group call me the next day to make sure Robbie was still alive and well, you know. But it was a big deal to us that he had been deceitful like that. You know, and I don't remember. People ask me sometimes after we tell the story, what were your consequences? Yeah. I don't remember the consequences. Robbie might remember the consequences. You could call him. But it was a big deal in our house that he had told this lie. You know, and it was funny because the teachers kind of thought it was cute and clever, you know, but we did not think it was cute and clever, you know. So it needs, I don't care how cute and clever your children's lies are, they need to be dealt with as lies. It needs to be a big deal. You know, with teaching integrity, it needs to be things like keeping your promises. You know, if you promise this friend that you were going to go spend the night with them on Friday, and then you get a better offer later in the week, you still go to that house that you promised you were going to go to. I mean, it's things like that, you know. If you join the ball team and you promise that you're going to be there through the whole season, you're going to play the whole season. You can quit ball after that. You know, that's how we teach integrity to our children, though, is you're going to keep your word to people. You know, make them keep promises even when it's inconvenient and they don't want to do it. You know, we need to teach our kids to be respectful of other people as well. We have a brother, the brother and his wife that runs the camp for us, the swamp. You know, he always says, your kids are special, but so is everybody else. You know, and sometimes, which is why I mentioned the self-esteem thing, you know, we're so on to the self-esteem thing in our society, that we want our kids to have great self-esteem, and we want them to be confident, and, you know, but what we're teaching our kids, trust me, we see it in the office every single day. In a lot of ways, we're teaching our kids, you're better than everybody else. And you don't have to treat anybody with any kind of respect. That's wrong. That's ungodly. You know, we need to teach our kids to be polite to other people. You know, remember manners?
Yeah.
Remember manners?
Yeah.
I don't know when they became unpopular, but at some point apparently they fell out of mode and I didn't know anything about it. You know, please and thank you. Opening the door for people, picking up things that people have dropped. We've got to teach our kids to be aware of these things and expect them to treat other people with this kind of respect. You know, things like responding to other people politely. Again, with Robbie, when he was a little kid, he was the kind of kid that could go off in the yard and play with a stick for 2 hours and be perfectly happy without any kind of social contact. So we would go into church and we would walk along. He also had some hearing problems. But we would walk along in church and people would say, hello, Robbie. And Robbie would just walk on. And so we spent about a year walking through church, holding this kid by the shoulders, turning him to face the other person and say, Robbie, say hello back. You know, you've got kids like that. You've got kids that just, they're in their own little world and they don't pay attention to other people. We've got to teach them other people are important. You know, things like sharing when they're little. You know, they've got to learn to share. When they're older, they've got to learn to respect other people's property. Being helpful, and this is one I think that we don't teach enough just in our own homes.
Right.
You know, we need to expect our kids to help us at home. Everybody lives in that house. It's everybody's job to do something. You know, and pretty much from the time they're two, they can pick up their own toys or they can, you know, go get something for mama or, you know, teach your kids, expect your kids to do this. You know, teach them to be aware of what's going on around them. You know, if you've got company coming over and mama is going crazy, the kids need to see that and say, what can I do to help, mom? You know, but we've got to train them how to do that. As they grow older, I think we need to give our kids an opportunity to serve people outside of their realm. of the people that they're in contact with all the time, like helping the homeless, you know, giving clothes to people that don't have clothes. We've got to help our kids understand that they are blessed in so many ways, and that they've got to help people that are not so blessed. Which, you know, I think is our kids. We've been blessed in our family because all three of our kids got to go on a Hope mission trip to Africa, different countries. Most of them paid their way to do it, but that was a life-changing event for our kids. You know, to go to Africa, to, you know, come home with pictures of, you know, 6 and 8 year old children sleeping in ditches and getting up and coming to the school that they were teaching at, and, you know, what an opportunity for our kids if we will just help them to know the blessings that God has given them and that they're responsible to help other people that haven't been given those blessings. You know, we need to be talking to our kids about how their behavior affects other people. And again, even in our homes, you know, if your kids do something that hurts your feelings, I think it's very appropriate for us to say, that really hurt my feelings, you know, what you said to me. That really made me upset when you told me that. You know, a lot of times, again, we're so focused on our kids' self-esteem that we don't tell them sometimes you're being a little jerk, you know. And they need to know that, because if they treat us like that, they're going to treat other people like that as well. You know, when your kids have a conflict with someone else, don't automatically jump on their side, you know. But there's a possibility, a really, really good possibility, they're doing something wrong that you need to be training. You know, one question we learned to ask very early on with our kids is, what part did you play in this? What's your sin in this situation? I don't want to talk about the other person. This is especially helpful with brothers and sisters, by the way. I don't want to talk about what the other person did. I want to hear what you did wrong. What did you do wrong? You talk about taking the wind out of somebody's sails. That'll do it, you know. And it will solve the problem a lot of times very, very quickly, you know. But we need to help our kids understand that they're responsible for their behavior and their part in conflicts.
All right. I see glazed faces and yawns and stretches. But if you don't mind, we're going to jump right into our last topic because it's really important. I want to make sure we have the most time. Yeah, you've got to. So, we've talked about all these good things to have your kids do and raise them and train them and so forth. What do you do if they don't do any of that stuff and they're still crummy kids? So, that's what we're going to talk about. Discipline. The contentious topic of discipline. And let me tell you, there is no subject that can cause more heated opinions than this topic of discipline. We give talks all over the place and sometimes to secular groups. And there used to be a psychiatric hospital in our town in Athens, and they would invite us to speak a lot. We'd talk to parents about parenting. And we do all this stuff we just did for you, and at the end, we didn't intend to talk about discipline, right? You know, we talk about ADHD and learning disabilities and stuff like that. At the end of the talk, someone would always raise their hand and say, "What do you think about corporal punishment?" Now, I didn't have the time to soften them up like I did with you, you know, or to talk about our biblical convictions, so I would have to say, well, you're looking at the two psychologists in Athens that are actually pro-corporal punishment. Those words got out of my mouth, then the whole room would erupt. And you'd have half the room go, "Yeah, that's right, beat your kids, the psychologist said it, you know? Yeah, discipline." The other half would get up, storm out, and write us nasty emails for a year. This is a very contentious topic. Some parents firmly believe in strict discipline. Others believe that no discipline is good. Because it stifles the child's creativity or personality or whatever. We went to, we've talked in Jamaica a few times about parenting. Let me tell you, that's one thing we don't have to talk the Jamaicans into, is corporal punishment. They are all over that. And they do a good job of it. What we have to talk to them about is tempering your corporal punishment with love and compassion and understanding. Psychological experts on child rearing aren't even consistent on that. They're one end of the spectrum to the other. You know, when our parents grew up, my parents anyway, not yours, because I would be some of your guys' parents. When my parents grew up, our parents, there was no question. No question. Spare the rod, spoil the child. They were into strict discipline.
Oh, yeah.
Then we went into the 60s and 70s, and things changed. You know, it's like more, you know, no, you have to let children express themselves, and, you know, don't put too many limits on your children. And, you know, we see where that's gotten us, right? The children in the 80s and 90s. Let me tell you, when it comes, I'm a psychologist, I believe in research and science and empirical evidence. Let me tell you, what the world says about discipline today, it's going to change. In 10 years, we're going to be seeing something completely different. That's why I don't read the professional journals for advice about discipline. I read my Bible.
Amen.
It's why God says in 1 Corinthians 1:19, oh yeah, 1 Corinthians 1:19 says, I will destroy the wisdom of the wise, the intelligence of the intelligent I will frustrate. I love that scripture. Experts cannot tell you how to discipline your kids, because that expertise will change from year to year. When it comes to making decisions how to raise our kids and discipline them, we only need one expert. And that's God. And that Bible says the same thing about it now as it did 10, 20, 50, 100, 1,000 years ago. It says the same thing. Biblical wisdom about discipline does not change. What we are saying, going to say now, is not by virtue of all our education and degrees and stuff like that. It's what I'm going to tell you now is what we've seen from the benefit of 30 years of practice and seeing what works and what doesn't work in terms of discipline. And we've seen the failure of the world. The failure of the world when they don't adhere to biblical principles of discipline. I have no problem saying that, and it is the truth. So the first thing we have to do is define what we mean by discipline. Most people think when we say discipline, they think punishment. That's the first thing they think. Oh, he's going to talk about discipline, how to punish your kids. Discipline is much more than that. Discipline is a system. It's an entire system of training. Training your child's behavior, his attitudes, and his beliefs. The goal being that at some point they're going to be able to discipline themselves. In the office, I use the example of it being the tug of war. You know, you've got one end, your kid's got the other end. You want to let out freedom, give them more freedom. As they become more self-disciplined, when they turn 18 or so, you're going to be able to let go of that rope. If they violate your trust, you pull in the rope. So it's really a system that involves constant teaching and correcting and encouraging and modeling, not just punishment. But let's look at the biblical foundation for discipline. I'm going to read to you Hebrews 12, 5 through 11. And you've forgotten the word of encouragement that addresses you as sons. My son, do not make light of the Lord's discipline, and do not lose heart when he rebukes you, because the Lord disciplines those he loves, and he punishes everyone he accepts as a son. Endure hardship as discipline. God is treating you as sons. For what son is not disciplined by his father? If you're not disciplined, and everyone undergoes discipline, then you are illegitimate children and not true sons. That's pretty clear. Moreover, we've all had human fathers who disciplined us, and we respected them for it. How much more should we submit to the Father of our spirits and live? Our fathers disciplined us for a little while as they thought best, but God disciplines us for our good, that we may share in His holiness. No discipline seems pleasant at the time, but painful. Later on, however, it produces a harvest of righteousness and peace for those who have been trained by it. This passage makes it pretty clear several things. One is that discipline is part of love. It equates discipline and love. If God disciplines those he loves, we should follow that example and discipline our kids who we love. A lot of people today feel like discipline is harmful, or if you love your kids, you won't discipline them. But the very opposite is true. We just read it. Children, like I said before, they know they need limits. We need to love our kids enough to discipline them, which is not only punishing them, but training them, rebuking, correcting, teaching, and setting an example. The passage also says that discipline produces a harvest of righteousness and peace for those who've been trained by it. That's very true. If you discipline correctly and biblically, what do we want? Peace in our home. We want peace. That's the harvest you'll get from it. But later it will produce peace in your child because they'll be able to control their own impulses. They'll be self-disciplined, which is really a source of freedom and peace. So, what we're going to focus on is to teach obedience by enforcing discipline. And we're going to focus mostly on young kids. Teens is a whole different thing. But if you already have older children and you haven't learned to set a foundation in what we're going to talk about today, it makes it that much harder. But if you haven't started to employ the things we're going to talk about for a half an hour, it's never too late either. Okay, so Mary's going to talk a little bit about, introduce our discussion about corporal punishment, which is the big kahuna.
Yeah, when Michael recently wrote this talk, and I noticed that I got this part, I was like, oh, thank you so much, honey. We're going to talk about spanking, is what we're going to talk about. And like Michael said, this is a huge issue right now. It is a huge issue. A lot of Christians are really wavering on this issue and really concerned about this issue, honestly concerned, and I can certainly understand why. So what I'm going to talk about is the state of the current psychological research on spanking, which may be a little surprising to you guys. I think there is this concept, this understanding, this notion that spanking has been proven to be harmful to our children in the current research. That spanking causes our children to be aggressive, more aggressive, and that's been proven by the current psychological research. And that is not the case. That is not the state of the current psychological research. Let me tell you a little bit, first of all, about the spanking studies themselves. Most of the spanking studies were done in a couple of different ways. The original studies were done by people, the researchers put video cameras up in homes, and they recorded interactions between the parent and their children. And any instance of a child being hit was considered a spanking. Okay? And that was, and I saw some of these films. Some of them are, you know, some of those instances were what in Georgia we call a pop, you know, where, you know, the kid, literally, mama's sitting on the couch, the kid runs by in front and does something, and he gets hit, all right? That's called a pop in Georgia, you know? That is not a spanking, okay? That is not a biblical, that is not disciplining your child for their behavior. That is hitting your child because you're irritated with them, okay? That's abusive in my mind, you know, that's abusive. You know, some of them were instances of where it became abusive to the child. Most of the research does not screen out any instances of abuse when they talk about corporal punishment. You know, and Michael's going to go through in a minute what we consider an appropriate spanking, you know. But the research does not screen those things out. I mean, all of that went in together, and they looked at all of that together. You know, the second thing is the research, the body of research on spanking is not clear what the outcomes are. There's still a huge raging controversy with camps on both sides as to whether spanking actually is harmful and actually does cause your children to be more aggressive or not. I'm going to just tell you a few things on the kind of the pro-spanking camp. There is a researcher, probably the head researcher that looks at some of the errors in the spanking research is a man by the name of Robert Larzelere, Larzelere. And he's with Boystown. He's a psychologist with Boystown, a PhD. And what he has done recently is he has looked at a lot of the different spanking studies, looked at them together. And this was one of his findings that was published in December 2000 in the Clinical Child and Family Psychology Review. And this is a quote: "Not one of the 17 causally related studies found predominantly detrimental outcomes for spanking if they did anything to rule out parents who use physical punishment too severely." So in other words, if you look at a large body of these studies and you take out any instances of severe physical punishment, abuse, then there's nothing to say that it causes your children to be more aggressive. One of the ones that I find most interesting, there's a number of countries in Europe that have outlawed spanking. Spanking is illegal in these countries. I think it's about 9 right now. It is not illegal in any state in the Union currently, right now. But in Sweden, banned spanking in 1979. They had a huge problem with child abuse in Sweden, and they had a huge problem with juvenile delinquency in Sweden. And so one of the things that they did to try to address these problems is they outlawed spanking. They made spanking illegal because they looked at the research and they said, it must be causing our kids to be aggressive. This is why we're having so many problems. What they expected to happen over time is that their child abuse rate would decrease and the aggressiveness in teenagers would decrease, the teen violence would decrease. In fact, the opposite occurred. Since they had outlawed spanking in 1979, reports of serious child abuse has increased fourfold and teenage violence has increased ninefold. That's a pretty big study. That's a country.
Yeah.
That's an entire country. Now, obviously, there are other factors going on in there, but that's a pretty big study.
Mm-hmm.
Let me get on my soapbox for just a second. Let me tell you what is making our kids aggressive. Our television, our movies, and our video games that we're letting them be exposed to. And it amazes me. What amazes me as a psychologist is that research is clear. It has been out there for a long time, and everybody is ignoring it. You know, if your kids are playing Grand Theft Auto, they're going to be aggressive, okay? If they are watching aggressive movies, they're going to be more aggressive. We know that. All of that literature is there, and our society is totally ignoring it. That's what's making our kids aggressive.
I believe that.
Wow. She has convictions about stuff. She's scary. You know, regardless of what the research says, the Bible is very clear on this subject. Proverbs 13:24. He who spares the rod hates his son, but he who loves him is careful to discipline him. Mary, in another class, she does a whole thing about the biblical, what the rod signifies. It wasn't just a thing to beat someone with. The shepherd used the rod to guide the sheep and to count them, and you know, very interesting study. Proverbs 22:15, folly is bound up in the heart of a child, but the rod of discipline will drive it far from him. Most parents, most secular parents, know the spare the rod, spoil the child. What they don't know, Colossians 3:21, fathers, don't exasperate your children. Or they'll become, it actually says, don't embitter your children, or they will become discouraged. Ephesians 6, fathers, do not exasperate your children. These scriptures tell us to watch out for our own temper while we're punishing. How do we exasperate our children? How do we embitter them? By misapplying these scriptures in a way, like I said before, just to make your own life more peaceful or quiet, or to get a kid to do something, instead of using the rod to build character, to train your kids. So, that having been said, let me tell you what we've come up with as the best way to use corporal punishment, and specifically how to do it. And I teach this to parents who have no interest in the Bible in my office. Non-Christian, pagan parents who, by the time they come into the office, their kids are so off the chain, they are ready to do anything. Now, I'll ask parents first. I'll say, listen, I want to talk to you about corporal punishment. But if you're uncomfortable with this, I'll never mention it again. A lot of parents come in and say, you know, I was beaten or abused as a child, and I said I would never do it. Cool. If you're not a disciple, now if you're a disciple, I'll have a different talk with you. But if you're a secular, patient parent, you know, fine. We won't do it. We'll talk about other things, time out and so forth. For the rest of them, you know, most of the times, by that time, parents' convictions about not using discipline are totally broken down. They're desperate to do anything, and they say, tell me. Just tell me what to do. I'll do it. When they say that, I have the following discussion with them. It's a system I think I invented, I'm not sure, but I call it the 3D system. And the premise is this, that there are three things that should always get a spanking. And I'll tell you in a minute about what the spanking is and how you do it. Three things should always be met with a spanking. And they all begin with D. Disobedience, disrespect, and dangerous behavior, or danger. Disobedience, disrespect, and danger. Now here's what you do, I tell my parents. First, you're going to have to tell your kids what these three things are that they're from now on, the rest of their lives, going to get a spanking for. So on a good day, when you're not mad at them, when no one's mad at anyone, everyone's happy, you sit down with them and say, son or daughter, there's some things going on that need to stop. And we'll talk in a minute about how young you can be to start doing this. But you say, the three things that you'll get a spanking for from now on are disobedience, disrespect, and danger. Do you know what disobedience is? No. It's every time you don't do what mom or I tell you to do the first time. Or it's when you say, okay, I'll do it, but you still don't do it. That's disobedience. The next thing is disrespect. You know what that is? No. And on this, I tell the parents you can kind of customize it. Well, it's any time you know how when we tell you to do something, sometimes you go like that, or you make a face, or you call someone a name, or you mumble under your breath, or any of those things are disrespect, and you can customize it to your kid. The last one is danger. You know what that is? No. It's when you push your sister off her skateboard. It's when you get into your dad's power tools after he told you to 92 times. It's when you play with matches, or, you know, you got a bunch of those too. So this is what you tell your child. Every time you do one of these 3Ds, we're going to give you a spanking. Now, how you apply the spanking is thusly. We believe in using a implement. Now, some of my colleagues who are against corporal punishment call it a weapon. A weapon is something you use to harm somebody, right? This is something different. We believe in using a thing for a couple of reasons. One is, you don't want to... Kids will transfer, they'll project all their hatred onto the thing and not you. They can hate the thing all they want.
Yeah.
The other thing is, you don't want to condition kids to your hand. You know, if you're spanking with your hand, where every time you reach out, they go, oh, sorry, I thought you were going to spank. The other thing is, and please take this in the spirit in which it's intended, many people, if you use your hand, you can't make a significant enough impact, especially moms, or sometimes moms. Okay, politically incorrect all the way around, I realize that. So, for those reasons, so you don't hurt yourself, but you make an impact, we use an implement. Now, the form that implement takes is very important. And this is, in Georgia, we tell parents, no switches, cutting switches. No belts, because a belt buckle could come loose and you hit the kid in the eye. Don't use anything that will cause a bruise, permanent injury, or anything where they could go to school and, you know, the teacher sees this wound and says, and calls DFACS. In Georgia, it's called Department of Family and Children's Services. What we advise is to use something big and broad that makes a big impact but doesn't leave any permanent, you know. Now, when our kids were little, we must have gone through a million of those little, you know, those boinka, boinka, boinka paddles. Yeah, those break too easily. You know, ping pong paddles, they break too easily. One time, when our kids were little, we took them out to hunt to shop collectively for the spanking thing. We did. So we went to this toy store, and I found this thing. It's a beach, some kind of beach game. It's got a big, huge plywood broad paddle and a little teeny ball. And I'm looking at this thing, and I'm saying, this is awesome. It's got foam grip. It's three-ply. The one we found even had a figure. It's like an African going like this, and I'm like, that's it. And our kids, because we weren't in the heat of battle at the moment, were like, yeah, that's cool. So that became Mr. Spanker. Now let me tell you another important thing about having a thing, and this is very important for dads. When we had Mr. Spanker, I put it in a place that was inconvenient for me to get to. I put it upstairs in the laundry room on a shelf. And there was only one. That way, in the time it takes me to get up and go get the thing, I can make sure I'm dressed and in my right mind. That I'm not angry and that I'm doing this safely. When you make this contract, the beauty of this is you're making a contract with your child to be responsible for his own behavior. The problem with spanking in the secular world is it goes like this. A parent says, Billy, do this. Billy, do this. Billy, I said do this. You know, and then when they get up and they finally are willing to spank, they're out of control. The beauty of what we're talking about is you've made a contract with a child. Every time you do this, every time, you're going to get a spanking. It is now no longer my responsibility. I am now just God's instrument of punishment. That way, you don't have to get mad. We made this agreement. I don't have to escalate and tell you again and tell you again. We've made a contract. You're going to do this the first time, and if not, you're going to get a spanking. Seriously, this helps you feel less... we're supposed to be putting responsibility on the child to manage his own behavior. And this will help.
Yeah.
So once you've chosen your spanker, every time they do one of these D's, they get the spanking. Now, no pants down, nothing humiliating. But they get three spanks to the butt. Nowhere else. Now, I tell parents to tell their kids, if you're fighting me, if you're squirming around, and your hand gets back there, and I hit your hand, it is not my fault. That encourages them to be still. They get the three spankings. And let me tell you one more thing. All the research with rats and pigeons and mice shows that a punishment is most effective when it's administered, when it has a lot of impact, and when it's administered immediately after the behavior. That's the beauty of spanking. When you take things away, which is also valid in certain circumstances, if you say, you were disobedient, you lose your video games for the day, what incentive does this kid have to behave the rest of the day? Nothing. No. He's already lost his video games. So he misbehaves again. What are you going to do? Say, well, you lost them tomorrow, too. And the next day. And the next day. And little kids can't think that far. Once you say, you lost your video games until 2012, they're like, I don't know what that means, so I'm just going to cut loose, you know? The beauty of a spanking is it's immediate, and then it's done. Then you're ready to reset for the next one if they make another offense. Now, here's what you do. They get the three spankings. And then what some parents do that's wrong, what do? After they give a spanking?
They console.
No, that's right. The wrong thing is when they turn them around immediately and say, now, you know we love you and this hurts me more than it does you. Baloney. And and we just want you to grow. No, if you do that immediately, you've just erased what transpired in the 10 minutes before. So what we say is you do the three licks, and then they go to timeout for a period set by you. And that period, generally speaking, is usually one. You've heard this rule, 1 minute per year of age. So if it's 10-year-old, he goes to his room for 10 minutes. You don't say, now go to your room until you're ready to talk about this. because he's going to take three steps and turn around and go, okay, I'm ready to tell you what I did. No way. You're not even close, you know? Or you don't say, oh my goodness, the disciple thing. Now go to your room until you're ready to have a happy heart. You can't let... Okay, I'm just going to say it. I hate that term. You can't legislate your kid having a happy heart. I mean, and he's going to turn around and say, okay, I have a happy heart. No, no, no. You have to take full control of how long that kid's in timeout. So it's the spanking. 1 minute. They go to timeout. The purpose of that is to give him 10 minutes to get control of himself. So then you can debrief him. Now, if after that 10 minutes, he's still smashing stuff in his room, which incidentally is fine. It's his stuff. If you want to wreck it, that's fine. I'm just not going to get you a new one. 10 minutes, they're having a fit. Okay, 10 more minutes, because obviously you're not ready to talk about this. So you do it in blocks of time. We call that a fixed interval, schedule of reinforcement. That's a scientific term for it. When they're finally ready to talk about it, then you do the debriefing. Do you know why you got the spanking?
No.
It's, well, by that time they're not like that. They're, no. It's because you were disobedient. Do you remember what that is? No. It's when you don't do what we tell you to the first time. Now, you might have to repeat this 8,000 times, but that's fine. You want to come up with this operational definition. Now, that's why, you know, now you can say this. We love you. We do this because God tells us to. God instructs us to do this. And, you know, we feel great about it. And then they're off again. Does that make sense? So, that's when you have the debriefing. Now, be prepared. I tell parents, in the research on rats and pigeons, when you stop reinforcing a behavior, for a while it gets worse. Until the animal is convinced that it's not going to get reinforcement anymore. And only at that point does the behavior stop. So I tell parents, if you've not been good at doing this, being consistent, for a while, your kid's going to test you. And there are going to be days where you think all you did was beat this kid all day. Mary and I went through that. We're alleged experts. There were plenty of times we lay there in bed going, we didn't have a single positive moment with that kid. We damaged him for life. We're psychologists, and they're going to be messed up, you know? We can now tell you from our vantage point of having three wonderful disciples that it did yield its benefits. The trick for you guys is going to be being consistent. Because I know what it's like. You come home at the end of the day, and it's like you're finally flopped down in your chair, and the last thing you want to deal with is getting up and spanking the kid or whatever. But I tell parents, you've got to do this every time. And none of this, dads, where you go, I'm going to get the spanker. I'm getting this. You better. I'm getting the spanker. And then they go do what you say. And then you go, all right. Next time you better snap to it. You know, just sit there in your chair. The only thing that does is teach your child he's got that much more time to be disobedient before he gets serious. It's got to be immediate, and it's got to be every time. And I just warn parents, and I say, this is going to be exhausting for a while. But once that child is convinced, it's going to drop off significantly. Let me say one more quick word. What do you do when you're out in public? This is a big thing.
Oh, yes.
Kids seem to think, and they've had every reason to believe this, that they're immune when they're in public, right?
Yes.
Because they think when you're in Walmart, you're not going to embarrass yourself by disciplining them. No. And it's true. Disciplining them publicly is embarrassing and humiliating. However, the rules can't change, and the kids can't feel like they have you over a barrel just because you're in public. So, under those circumstances, we have what we call the porta spanker. It's a smaller, more portable implement that does the same thing. When it was our kids, it was a little plastic thing you used to get slices of pie out, a little triangular thing. And we kept it in the van, you know, because this is what you do. The kids can't be led to think that these three D's change when they're elsewhere.
Yeah.
So as soon as they do one of these D's again, you drop everything. Be prepared to stop shopping. Drop everything if you have to. You physically get that kid out of the reinforcing environment where he thinks he's immune. If you have to physically pick him up and take him, not to the bathroom, but to your van, which you strategically parked in a place away from all defects caseworkers. You take him out to the van, and you do the same thing. The three lists, you sit in the van for 10 minutes. Now are you ready to go back in? But you prepare them for it first. Before you even go shopping, you say, now there are some times where, when we're shopping, I can get you a surprise or something, or you know, we'll go to a Chuck E. Cheese or something. This is not one of those days. So I'm warning you before we even get in the car. If you whine, that will be considered disobedience and you'll get a spanking. Another day we'll go and we'll get you a present or something like that. So now let me just last say about this thing about, you know, parents, a lot of secular parents think, isn't this just teaching our kids to be violent? There is a difference, and kids know it, between a judiciously applied spanking, which is their responsibility, versus this impulsive, escalating, you get mad. Now, I've worked with, I have defects caseworkers as patients, as advisors, as students when I teach at Piedmont College. I ask them all the time, what do you think about spanking? And they all tell me, we don't take kids away. At least it's in Georgia. I don't know about anywhere else. They've told me, we don't take kids away from their parents for being spanked. We take them away for abuse. Now, I did say this very same thing once when we gave a talk in New Jersey, and one parent said, no, I gave a spanking, and they took my child momentarily away. And that's an exception, terrible as that was. But I feel so strongly about this, and when I recommend it and we go over it with my parents in the office, I tell them this. I say, I'm going to write down, if you're willing to do this, I'm going to write down in your chart that I told you to do this. If you get any trouble about it, for any reason, you call me. I will show them in my notes where I'll take full responsibility. I'll show them in my notes where I told you to do this. And it's because I feel that strongly about it, and because I know, or I trust, that God is going to reward this. Now, you balance this with all this other stuff we've been talking about. The family time, the one-to-one time, stuff like that. All right? I'm making a distinction here. The last question people usually have about spankings is the ages. How young do you start it? As soon as your child is capable of willful, defiant behavior, that's when you start. Parents say, how do you know when that is? It's when you do this. When you say to the toddler, don't touch the DVD, and your toddler goes, that is willful and defiant behavior. If they can do that, that's when they start. Now, they may be too little to even say the word disobedience, but they understand what you're spanking them for, and you do it, you know, you do a mini version, you know, they're too little to be putting time on all that stuff, but you start, that's when you start it. When you end it, there's really no rule of thumb. You will know, though, I think, when you get that feeling like there are some things that are now more important to this kid than getting spanked. Our eldest, Amanda, who is a social junkie, she thrives on human contact. If you deprive her of that, when she was little, she'd take a million spankings over a timeout because being a timeout deprived her of human contact, and she'd be like, that was, you know, when it came to that point where obviously the spankings, they're willing to put up with a spanking to get what they want. Now it's time for something different. And certainly never like with a dad spanking a girl. You'll know in that inappropriate age. It's, you know, generally around 8, 9, 10 at the outside is usually when we stop that. For the rest of the times, we take a minute to talk about it. I promise, 5 minutes to talk about some other things besides spanking.
You know, I do want to share with this whole, if you're struggling with this thanking issue, you know, when Michael and I became Christians, we'd been married 5 years, we had two little kids, like 3 and 1, and we knew all this research, all this psychological research on spanking, and we knew what the Bible said, and we had a decision to make. We had to make a decision. We also knew that psychological research is man-made, and it changes. It changes. It's going to look totally different 10 years from now than it looks now. You know, that was the decision we had to make. Is that, are we going to bet our kids' souls on the psychological research, or are we going to bet our kids' future on the Word of God? You know, that's what it came down to. You know, for me personally, for Michael, that's what it came down to. So, you know, pray through this if you're struggling with this. Do some research on your own. But, you know, that's the two choices you're up against, really. Let me move quickly. I'm going to get you out of here real quick. Let's talk about a couple of other forms of discipline. You know, I just read an interesting article on discipline that talked about, you know, you don't want to use the most severe punishment for something that's a minor infraction. You know, you want to try to make the punishment fit the crime, is basically what it said. And so you want to kind of graduate your punishments according to the behaviors that you're trying to address. So let's talk about timeout real quickly. You know, every parent in the world right now knows that when you're asked what kind of discipline to use with your child, the appropriate answer is supposed to be timeout, right? Timeout. And the fact is, timeout can be a very effective form of discipline, but it's a very hard thing to do correctly. And most parents we talk to in the office, we'll say, do you use timeout? And they'll say yes, and we'll say, does it work? And they'll say, absolutely not. You know? And the reason is because timeout, the psychological term is timeout from reinforcement. And that means that you are supposed to place the child in an environment that is so boring that it's a punishment for them. That's really hard to do outside of a clinical lab. That's really hard to do in a clinical lab with some kids. You know, there are some kids that will find a piece of lint on the bottom of their shoe in timeout, you know, and make balloon animals out of it, you know. I mean, there's, you know, sometimes timeout is really, really hard. It's hard to get the child in an environment that is so boring that they find it punishing, as a punishment. About the best you can do in your home is something like a chair in the corner or a chair in a boring room. You know, in our house, it was the stairs come down into the entryway of the house, and there's nothing in that entryway. There's like a door and a grandfather clock, but nothing interesting to a child. And it was separated from most of the family activities went on in the back of the house. So to put the child at the bottom stairs of that stairwell was pretty boring for them. So that's what you're trying to do. You're trying to get the child in a boring place. The rule for timeout is they are supposed to be there for 1 minute for each age, year of age. So if you have a 5-year-old, they're supposed to sit for 5 minutes in timeout. If you have a 3-year-old, they're supposed to sit for 3 minutes in timeout. Now, the trick with this is when they're in timeout, there should be nothing reinforcing happening between you and that child. So if the child is sitting in timeout going, Daddy, is it time? I think it's time. I think I've been here long enough. You know, that's not timeout, all right? You know, if you're talking back and forth, they're not in timeout. You know, if they are kicking the wall and screaming, then they need another 3 minutes in timeout. You know, it is 3 minutes where they sit there and get themselves under control. That's the goal that you're going for timeout. Am I missing anything in timeout? Okay, let me move quickly. Loss of privileges, loss of toys. You know, sometimes this is the most natural consequence for inappropriate behavior. You know, if your two kids are fighting over a toy, the most appropriate consequence is probably take that toy away and we'll try it again tomorrow and see if you guys can share the toy, you know. Or, you know, because you were fighting with your brother or sister, you don't get to go outside and play. You know, loss of privileges. With teenagers, this is the drug of choice. This is the punishment you want to use with teenagers. Take privileges away from them. Take the car keys away from them. Take the cell phones away from them. Take the ball game on Friday night away from them. That's the punishment that you want to use with teenagers. I'm going really fast here, I know. Michael talked a little bit about room restriction, which is a form of timeout where you send the child to their room for a period of time. Let me just say, if your child has a plasma TV and video games and a wet bar in the room, it's not timeout. And a lot of our kids, that's where you send them. Okay, that is not a punishment. So, you know, they have to be removed to a place that they find not good, or it's not a punishment. Just an aside, but I have to say this because we don't have time to do this class in this series of classes. We are absolutely convinced, and we go around the country begging people to not put TVs and computers in children's bedrooms or teenagers' bedrooms. We have heard horror stories, and if you want to save your children, please put your televisions and your computers in a public access place in your home where everybody knows what everybody is watching. That's an aside.
Amen.
All right, one more piece of advice. Oh, by the way, the taking away privileges, there should be some things that don't get ever taken away. Like if you're having a birthday party, something really special, it only happens once a year, or a vacation you're going on as a family, something like that. Some things you don't want to take away. You take away other things that are, you know, temporal or repetitive. And some things, you know, or being able to play in the finals, you know. That's something different because you have an obligation to the rest of the people on the team, you know. So certain things like that you try not to take away. Now, the last piece of advice, in addition to being consistent, be persistent. About 100 times a week, I have parents come in and say, well, we tried that. Actually, when I first meet parents, I say, what do you do for discipline? Well, we tried timeout, but it didn't work, so we tried spanking. And that didn't seem to work. This kid's impregnable to discipline. The fact is, kids know if they act like it doesn't have an impact on them, that you will stop and you'll do something else. Kids learn that really quickly. So I tell parents, I don't care. They say, I give my kid the spanking, but he just turns and smiles. Provided you're spanking sufficiently hard, I don't care if it appears that it's having an effect or not. We're trying to teach them that there is a punishment every time that there's this behavior. If you capitulate to what he's doing in response to that, you're just going to give up and you're going to quit and move on to something else. That just teaches the child, all I have to do is hold out. And they'll stop doing this and they'll do something else. So whatever you choose to do, timeout, room restriction, whatever, just do it consistently. That'll do more than God, as we read, was very consistent in Leviticus. Just imitate that. Thank you so much for your time and attention.